Joplin Park, but it looks like cloudy skies for the rest of us. Highs today in the upper 60s, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, a nearly 100% chance of rain tomorrow. It's 63 in Lawrence. This is KPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at CIDQ.org/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Artificial intelligence is used in everything from creating funny images on the internet to organizing office records. And increasingly, it's also an integral component to healthcare. But some patient advocacy groups are worried. They want more regulation of AI in the healthcare industry. Last month, experts from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration agreed in an article they wrote for JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association. To tell us more, we're joined by the senior author of the paper, FDA Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf. Thank you for being here.
Aisha, it's great to be with you.
You write that over the past 30 years, the FDA has authorized nearly 1,000 medical devices that use artificial intelligence. Can you give us an idea of what these devices do?
You know, I think of it in terms of categories. So there's definitely a category where most of the action has been is in imaging, a CT scan or an X-ray, and you want to make sense of it. The radiologist looks at it as a human being, and there's limited processing capability that we all have. A computer never gets tired, doesn't need a cup of coffee, and can analyze the data on a broad scale. But the much, much larger area that has implications for all of us is what's called decision support. And that is either a consumer looking on the internet, or you're a doctor or a nurse dealing with a patient. You're inputting information. That information is processed, and it gives you a recommendation.
How does the FDA right now evaluate AI-enabled devices? Can you sketch out the process just generally for a layperson?
There are actually a set of laws that govern this. So if it's an AI algorithm which is embedded in a high-risk device, let's say a cardiac defibrillator, that's a really good example. If your heart suddenly stops beating, you want a shock to get your heart started again. You want to make sure that algorithm is right. That is very carefully regulated, and you got to do clinical studies, typically in people, that show that the algorithm actually really works. You have administrative uses of AI. Those aren't regulated at all. That's administration and finance. And in the middle, we have this vast area of decision support that I described. And that ranges from I'm working out and I want to know what my heart rate is to I've got heart failure, I could die. I want to make sure when I work out, I've got careful control of the parameters, and that would be more regulated. So there's a spectrum. Bottom line on all this is that this field will be so big, we couldn't possibly hire enough people at the FDA to regulate it all on our own. And so it's very important that we get the clinical community, the health systems, the professions that of the people that you see for your healthcare to be very involved in developing what we would call an ecosystem of regulation, where these algorithms can be constantly evaluated.
So there are some advocates who seem to think that the products that help with, say, decision support, they should also go through clinical trials. Do you agree with that? Do you think that they should go through clinical trials?
Well, you know, in addition to being a cardiologist, I was a clinical trialist. That's what I did for a living. So I've never seen a clinical trial I didn't like. And of course, the more clinical trials we can do on these algorithms, the better. But I'd also point out there's an element of this which is different. You know, when you produce a drug or a traditional device, it's the same thing for the rest of its existence. Here, the decision support, the AI algorithms are changing every day. And so the real key here is making sure they're safe at the beginning and then monitoring them. So I think the consumer advocacy groups are onto something here, and we'll have to work out exactly where to draw the line in the pre-market phase for these algorithms, what it takes for them to get on the market versus what happens afterwards.
I think one concern that people will have, and one example that's come up, is say if an AI product is using billing records to predict someone's future healthcare needs, the AI may falsely presume that low-income people have fewer needs than wealthier people, but in reality, it's just that they have received fewer services because they don't have the resources to get them. Do your review procedures take things like that into account, or is that something that the FDA would have any insight on?
Well, you're asking a really important question there. And yes, we have a lot of insight into this. And you're completely right in the example that you gave, that if you have an AI algorithm, it's only as good as the data that goes in. But we're hyper aware of what you said, which is bias in the formulation of an algorithm leads to biased output and can make our inequities even worse than they already are. And they're pretty bad right now.
What do you say to those people who are concerned that, you know, a computer may be deciding whether they have some condition or not?
I think one of the most important things is, for the most part, for important decisions, AI should inform the clinician with whom you're working, not make the decision for that person. The decision should be made by a human being that's interacting with you, who can understand dimensions of you that are not necessarily easily picked up by a computer. On the other hand, I'd also point out that your doctor or nurse, as I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, could be tired, might have had a spousal fight in the morning before going to work, could be overwhelmed by other issues going on. A computer doesn't get tired and is not distracted by other things in the environment. In my 40 years of working on computer-human interfaces, the combination is always better as long as the rules of the road are right.
That's FDA Commissioner Dr. Robert Califf. Thank you so much for talking with me.
It's a real pleasure, and thanks for giving me a chance to go over this.
Younger people indicate they are less and less interested in institutional religion. At the same time, many say they want to make a difference in the world. NPR religion correspondent Jason DeRose found a group of people working to exploit the latter to address the former by breathing new life into the religious movement for social justice.
Most public policy lecture halls do not sound like this.
Woke up this morning with my mind.
Singer Yara Allen is warming up a class at Yale Divinity School in New Haven, one preparing the next generation of public ministers. Teaching this class is one of the most well-known religious leaders in America, Reverend William Barber.
The forces that are perpetrating extremism are not weak, and they are well-funded.
Barber, of the Poor People's Campaign and Repairers of the Breach, is retired from his congregation of three decades. Now, he's running the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale.
I've always wanted to train others, even as a pastor. I'd said, if I pastor somewhere 30 years and nobody gets called to preach and nobody gets trained, nobody, what kind of preaching have I done?
What he's done is lead one of the most prominent efforts to unite people around issues Barber says are deeply moral, deeply biblical.
What are the major tenets of religion as it relates to the public square? Love, truth, justice, mercy, grace. The least of these, the poor, the sick, the imprisoned. Look at this piece of legislation. How are these policies affecting people? How is it affecting their living and their dying?
Now, he's also helping upcoming leaders prepare for what he describes as urgent public witness.
If you don't stand and challenge poverty and denial of health care in this moment, in this life, you've wasted part of it.
In an age of atomization over identity politics, Barber's teaching what he calls moral fusion politics.
When people sit down across the lines that have tended to divide us, race, geography, sexuality, and they take an honest look at the politics of extremism, they figure out that the same people who are voting against people because they are gay are also blocking living wages.
If extremists, says Barber, are working together, then his side needs to come together too. This work extends beyond the classroom into the Div School's daily chapel.
God, you have chosen in your grace to be a God who shares the work. You invite us to labor alongside you and one another in the pursuit of hope, justice, and peace.
Before and after chapel, students huddle around Barber, updating him on projects, papers, fieldwork. Summer placements in churches working on voting rights and poverty are central. Student Benjamin Ball spent part of his summer in Alabama.
We were standing outside of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery, which is the church where Dr. King preached and worked, which is right outside of the Montgomery State Capitol.
For Ball, who's from Tennessee, the experience was transformative.
To stand outside of the doors of that church and see the state capitol right in front of you, I don't think there's a more profound image of if you walk out of church and ignore this, you're missing something right in front of you.
The point is that morality isn't the sole province of religious conservatives, says ministry student Ed Ford from Connecticut.
The gospel is telling us to do justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with our God. It's saying, if you're sick, would you care for me? If I'm a stranger, will you take care of me? If you are poor and those who are really suffering in the world, those are the things that we're supposed to be talking about. Jesus calls us to help the least of these, right?
Help not just through traditional direct service like food banks, says Ford, but also help through legislation and public policy.
Poverty doesn't know if you're black, white, Asian, Latino. It knows, though, at the root of it all in our country is our government going to step in and help people? Are our churches going to speak up and talk about what's right? Are we going to be chaplains of empire, or are we going to be prophets of God?
Sentiments that echo Barber's own language. Prophets who broach impolite topics, a lesson student Lizzie Chiavano from South Carolina began learning early in life.
Being from the South, there's no way to disconnect religion and politics because every social setting I walked into was both political and religious.
For instance, she says, both the government and churches provide food to poor families.
I grew up in poverty, and for people who are impacted by poverty and other forms of suffering, politics or religion are never far from their minds.
To be able to get the courage to then go and talk, that's what this is about.
Longtime civil rights leader and labor attorney Rosalind Woodward Pellis helps direct Yale's Center for Public Theology and Public Policy here in New Haven.
It's about spreading an understanding once you have it. This is institutionalizing the movement. And so it ends up in people's hearts. It ends up in changing religious education. And it ends up in strengthening the movement we're trying to build.
Through formation and tapping into a longing, says another of the center's leaders, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove.
Students here have a deep spiritual hunger connected to their sense that something is wrong with the way the world works.
For Wilson Hartgrove, the mission is to direct that sense of wrong into a sense of purpose.
It doesn't have to be this way, and God doesn't want it to be this way. And something inside of them tells them that it could be otherwise, and they can be part of that. And they want to know, how does that work?
We shall not, be moved.
Yara Allen again leads a room in song. This time, it's during a podcast interview William Barber is doing.
Welcome, everyone, to Creating the Leader's Way podcast together. So thank you for your presence.
In addition to teaching, Barber continues to be active in the movement around the country. No matter where he shows up, in class, in chapel, or an off-campus podcast recording, he draws a crowd eager to take up what Barber calls the cause of the Hebrew prophets and Christian gospels.
If you don't deal with public theology and you don't deal with issues of how we treat the least of these, you actually cut the scriptures apart.
Which is what he sees Christian nationalism doing today, using religion to divide rather than unite and harm rather than help, something Barber calls heresy.
Thy kingdom come, which is a direct announcement to Caesar that your stuff is not real, that your way of life has to pass because we're praying for another kind of kingdom to come that's rooted in love and justice and lifting all people.
And raising a new generation, working toward the community for which God longs. Jason DeRose, NPR News, New Haven.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. If you woke up this morning to a brighter day and feeling just a bit more rested than usual, your body is not playing tricks. This morning at 2 a.m., the clocks fell back an hour, marking the end of daylight saving time. How do people use that extra hour? Well, I, for one, use it to just feel better about my day. I feel like I have more time to get all the stuff I need to get done. We asked our colleagues and listeners how they plan to use that bonus hour, beginning with NPR White House reporter Asma Khalid, who says the campaign grind never stops.
When I first realized that daylight saving time was ending this weekend, I was ecstatic because I realized it means I get an extra hour of sleep, which at this moment I could very much use. I am tired of this crazy campaign cycle. We get an extra hour of it.
I'm Ben Abrams, and I am a nocturnal / semi-nocturnal producer on Morning Edition. And what I'm going to do for my extra hour this weekend is get as much sleep as I can because I'm pretty sleep deprived during the week. The weekend is like the one time I can get enough sleep and not feel like a zombie.
My name is Jungyoon Han. I'm with the Washington desk. On Saturday night, my roommates and I are hosting a party at our house. It's Halloween themed too, so we'll get to have an extra hour to dress up in our costumes.
My name is Haley Miller, and I'm a medical laboratory scientist in microbiology. I will be spending my extra hour continuing to provide patients with their lab results so that they can receive the care they need, and hopefully they can go home and enjoy that extra hour of sleep.
My name is Robert Scotch. I am a market setup and salesperson for Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm. Before the time change, I arrive in relative darkness. Post time change, there's almost full light for the setup, making for a much smoother process.
And for those nighthawks working in bars and clubs, daylight saving can make long nights even longer.
My name's Lonnie Nguyen, and I go by DJ Lonnie Love. I've been DJing for 17 years. I've DJed pretty much every daylight savings change. There was one night in particular that I DJed with my friend Bounce Castle, and the crowd was just so hype. And then when we told them they had an extra hour, it's like the room erupted. It was such a blast.
Now, not everyone enjoys this time shift, like sleep scientist Karen Johnson.
I will definitely be sleeping and getting an extra hour of sleep, but otherwise I've been busy this weekend advocating for permanent standard time.
Johnson is a neurologist and co-chair of the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time. And she says the disruption to our circadian rhythm can be harmful.
I think the science is clear. Standard time best aligns our natural circadian rhythms with the sun, which is best for our overall health.
Jamie Zeitzer, another sleep scientist, says daylight saving is a heated topic in the sleep science community.
Many of my colleagues are very much against it. I'm not so against it. I don't think it's ideal, but I think that the impact that it has in terms of our health is quite small.
Zeitzer will use that extra hour of sunlight to spend more time with family, although he's not typically a morning person.
Not by choice. My kids are morning people. My wife's a morning person.
I know I speak for everyone here at Weekend Edition when I say that extra hour of sleep is pretty nice. Standard time, we're glad to have you back. This is NPR News.
Pennsylvania's most recent Republican governor, Tom Corbett, wants people to trust the election process. He says former President Donald Trump's false claims about election fraud have undermined people's faith in elections.
4 years into this, there hasn't been any evidence that anything was rigged.
We talked to him about reestablishing trust in the most important state on the map, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 5 o'clock on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 96.1 FM in Lawrence. Online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR, helping Kansans make informed financial decisions for their families for over 45 years. More at bobschwartzfinancial.com.
When you think of a dangerous abolitionist in Kansas history, you probably think of John Brown. Next time on KPR Presents, the most dangerous abolitionist you probably haven't heard of before, James Montgomery.
The hard edge that the Civil War would take in terms of just massive destruction and death, Montgomery was sort of maybe a forerunner to at least some of that. So he really led kind of this singular anti-slavery journey.
David Schaefer and Todd Melfeld join me for KPR Presents 1 o'clock this afternoon on KPR 2, 6 o'clock this evening on KPR 1.
Support for KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, reminding listeners that dental health is closely linked to overall health and to visit a dentist regularly. Dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find.
Cloudy skies. We still have some rain falling in the Kansas City area. Chance of rain returning this evening. A 50% chance of rain overnight tonight. This is KPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options. At progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe, and it's time to play the puzzle. Joining us this week is Will Shortz. He's puzzle editor of the New York Times, but more importantly, he's puzzle master of Weekend Edition. Hey there, Will.
Good morning, Aisha.
So, Will, would you please remind us of last week's challenge?
Yes, I said name a place somewhere on the globe in two words, rearrange the letters of the first word to name some animals, and the second word in the place name is something those animals sometimes do. What is it? Well, the place is Hudson Bay. You can rearrange the letters of Hudson to get hounds, and hounds will bay at the moon.
There were only about 300 correct entries, so either everybody was getting ready for Halloween and carving their pumpkins and didn't, you know, submit their entries, or this was kind of tough. But this week's winner is John Byrne of Watertown, Massachusetts. Congratulations, John.
Thank you so very much. Good morning.
And I understand that today is a special day for you.
It so happens to be my birthday, yeah.
Happy birthday!
Thank you very much.
You should feel the collective energy of, I'm sure, you know, hundreds of thousands of people saying happy birthday at the radio right now.
I sure can. Thank you all.
How did you figure out this week's answer?
I focused on the second word first, figuring it would be a verb, you know, an action an animal would do. I was thinking of beach, and then that brought me to the bay, and then working backwards from there, you know, I landed in Hudson Bay.
Okay, well, you got it right. How long have you been playing the puzzle?
Oh, about 18 or 19 years.
And you've never won before, right?
Never won.
Today is your lucky day, and it's your birthday, so you probably should get a lottery ticket, too.
That's my plan for right after, yeah.
So, John, I got to ask you, are you ready to play the puzzle?
Aisha, I am ready.
Okay, take it away, Will.
All right, John. This is a phonetic puzzle. If I asked you to say the cry of a ghost plus a letter of the alphabet to get a bunch of flowers, you would say boo plus K to get bouquet. So now try these. Say the sound of a horse plus a letter of the alphabet to get a military force at sea.
Navy.
Navy is right. Say the sound of a cow plus a letter of the alphabet to get given to sudden changes in temperament.
Moody.
That's it. Say grind with the teeth plus a letter to get difficult to satisfy.
Oh, gosh. Grind with the teeth.
If you have food in your mouth, what do you do?
You chew?
Yes.
I'm stuck on this one.
Your kid might be very, with their eating, your kids might be very...
Oh, choosy.
That's it. Choosy. Good one.
Got it. Wow.
Say a French city with an annual film festival, plus a letter to get sweets.
Candy.
That's it. say, a dull shade plus a letter to get meat sauce.
A dull shade and a letter to get meat sauce. Gravy.
Gravy, is it? Say, huffed and puffed plus a letter to get a colorful bird.
Blue Jay?
You got it. Blue Jay is right. How about went across as a river plus a letter to get a stretchable fabric?
Spandex.
Spandex, you got it. And your last one, one who violates the Ten Commandments plus a letter to get the result of two things working together advantageously.
What's going on right now, Will? Synergy.
I like it.
Yes, there was definitely synergy, but not on my end because I could not give this. I think maybe you need to work backwards on this, but you didn't have any problems at all. You did an awesome job, John. How do you feel?
I feel great. I'm so happy to have done this, and I'm really appreciative of participating here. So thank you.
For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin as well as puzzle books and games. You can read all about it at npr.org/puzzle. And John, what member station do you listen to?
We are members at WBUR.
That is awesome. That's John Byrne of Watertown, Massachusetts. Thank you so much for playing the puzzle.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Will, what's next week's challenge?
Yes, it comes from listener Mark Maxwell Smith. Name a place where experiments are done. It's a two-word phrase. Drop the last letter of each word, and the remaining letters, reading from left to right, will name someone famously associated with experiments. Who is it? So again, a place where experiments are done, two words. Drop the last letter of each word, and the remaining letters, left to right, will name someone famously associated with experiments. Who is it?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, and click on the Submit Your Answer link. Remember, just one entry, please. Our deadline for entries this week is Thursday, November 7th at 3 p.m. Eastern. Don't forget to include a phone number where we can reach you. If you're the winner, we'll give you a call, and if you pick up the phone, you'll get to play on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and puzzle master of Weekend Edition, Will Shortz. Thank you, Will.
Thanks a lot, Aisha.
A decade ago, author Jeff Vandermeer introduced readers to Area X in his Southern Reach trilogy. Cut off from the rest of the continent, it's a place where nature has taken over, lush with vegetation and wildlife. Beautiful from the outside, but bad things tend to happen to the people who enter. They get sick, they die, or they turn into creepy, crawly creatures. Now Vandermeer is back with a long-awaited prequel to the series. NPR's Andrew Limbong spoke with him about returning to Area X.
You know how in the Star Wars prequels, you learn about how midichlorians sort of explain Jedi powers? Or how the Silmarillion has J.R.R. Tolkien explaining all the details and history and lore of the Lord of the Rings trilogy? There's not really any type of those direct answers in this prequel.
Yeah, I hate the Silmarillion.
That's author Jeff Vandermeer.
I've never really been into the idea of quote-unquote lore. I really wasn't that into the idea of doing another book in general until, like, the tactile reality of it, like the street-level reality of it hit me.
With all due respect, here's some lore to catch you up. The Southern Reach is a government agency tasked with exploring Area X. Without spoiling too much, you find out in the original trilogy that the Southern Reach is a bit of a mess. The second book in particular reads like a mashup between the X-Files and Office Space. But according to Vandermeer, all his novels are about systems and institutions going haywire.
Really, it's related to my day job experience where I worked for a lot of companies with that were like Lord of the Flies with middle management, and then dealing with government agencies and seeing just how like ritualistic they were.
This new book, Absolution, is split up into three parts. Much of it follows old Jim. He's a washed-up suit working for an opaque government agency exploring what would become Area X. A lot of his time is spent reading old agency reports, and he gets through a particularly grisly one, too graphic for me to get into here, but old Jim starts questioning the orders he's been getting from his higher-ups. Here's Vandermeer reading.
Could a thing debunked by science still impact a person if they believed it and had believed it for a long time? Did a fact not in fact matter if, in a sense, matter had a different authority? depending on one's perception of the truth.
It'd be easy to draw a line from this idea of unknowability to our current predicament of internet-driven information overload. But scientists, philosophers, religious thinkers have been pondering this question for, a few centuries now. Vandermeer says there's something unique that fiction can bring to the discussion.
Which is make you live in the psychological reality of a situation. So it clothes it differently.
And in the Southern Reach series, Vandermeer clothes this question of unknowability with a warped sense of the environment.
It's certainly thinking a lot about toxicity, right? Forms of pollution, contamination, and mutations.
Allison Sperling is an assistant professor of English at Florida State University who specializes in environmental fiction. When the original series came out, she published a paper about how Vandermeer spoke to our current ecological condition. A lot of people dissected his work that way. And since 2014, there's also been more and more fiction that tries to grapple with climate change.
I've seen a lot of articles and work come out about climate fiction in particular, right? Can climate fiction save the planet? These kinds of questions. But I think that weird fiction and weird ecofiction, like Jeff's, kind of really quite explicitly refuses to offer certain answers, right? Or certain ways that we're supposed to react or respond.
I never expected that it would necessarily be interpreted as eco-fiction or climate fiction. You know, sometimes there's subtext that you don't, as an author, don't understand is there. But, you know, what I would say is the thing that's been interesting is the subsidiary effects. Like the people who've come up to me saying, I became a marine biologist in part because of this book, or I went into environmental science in part because of this book, which I did not expect.
Based on our conversation, Vandermeer doesn't seem fully comfortable with being labeled a climate fiction author.
It's hard for me to see climate fiction as a speculative endeavor. And it seems useful to like try to avoid the categorization to some degree, also so that people can see novels for the totality of what they are.
Because you obviously don't get to the end of absolution and have all the answers to fix climate change. You don't get much of any answers. But you do get a better sense of how terrifying the questions are. Andrew Limbong, NPR News.
You may not know it, but minimalist music is everywhere. Of course, in concert halls, but also in movies, TV ads, and even pop music. That's a song by Taylor Swift. And as NPR's Tom Heisinger reports, that repetitive pulse imitates the single piece of music that helped launch minimalism 60 years ago.
That piece of music is by American composer Terry Riley, and it's called In C. On November 4, 1964, in San Francisco, Terry Riley and a group of like-minded musicians debuted In C. Riley says the music first came to him in unlikely circumstances.
I played ragtime piano at the Gold Street Saloon at the time, and I was riding to work on the bus when I heard this In C first line kind of came into my consciousness like somebody was playing it to me. So as soon as I got off work that night, I went home and wrote down the first line.
The rest of the music came to Riley quickly. Still, once he had all the musical ingredients, it wasn't quite ready for prime time.
When we first started rehearsing it, nobody, including me, knew how to play it. I had a kind of idea of how it should sound, but to rehearse it and actually turn it into music, it took a bit of doing.
It took some doing because NC has so few guidelines, and that's the idea. The composer gives up control. The score is just a single page. 53 little musical riffs that any group of musicians play in order but at their discretion. Every performance will, by design, sound completely different.
I was actually blown away by the notion of freedom that it presented.
Cellist Maya Beiser released her own version of NC earlier this year.
I immediately just felt that it was such a genius thing, akin to E equal MC squared. You know, just this idea that it's something so simple.
Armed with just her cello, a looping machine, and a pair of percussionists, Beiser emphasizes the deep, sometimes head-banging grooves inherent in the music.
This was the Nirvana section, because it's just it's very Kurt Cobain or Led Zeppelin.
Unlike Beiser's mostly solo approach, NC is usually played by a dozen or more musicians, which, Riley says, emphasizes its communal power.
One of the things that NC has done over the years has helped to connect people of different backgrounds.
And you could say that connection started big time in 1968 when Riley recorded NC for Columbia Records, catapulting this strange new music directly into the mainstream. These days, University of Maryland music professor William Robin brings his students together for annual performances of NC, most recently in May.
It's a really powerful live experience, and the nature of the music, it is at once fully notated, but it has the sound, the ethos of this kind of communal jam session where musicians are repeating these little riffs over and over and over again. What makes NC such a landmark work is that it is kind of right at the center of pushing the boundaries of what music could be, while also having this incredibly rich and attractive soundscape that's groovy in a way that pop music was groovy in the mid-60s.
And groovy enough today to attract a wide array of musicians, including an orchestra from Shanghai, to musicians from West Africa. There's a Swiss industrial band, Indian musicians from Brooklyn, and Japanese acid rock. Even at the beginning, Riley understood how NC was influential.
Other composers were taking an interest in what I was doing, so I knew that it was going to have some significance.
It was game-changing. Philip Glass and Steve Reich embraced Riley's evolving repetition. It's hard to imagine this Reich masterwork without NC. At 89, Riley, who now lives in Japan, is still composing and doesn't mind looking back to the piece that helped launch a musical movement.
NC is like one of your children. They went out, became famous, did some good things, met some other people, and turned out to be something different than you imagined at the beginning.
And it's not hard to imagine that NC will remain a piece that fascinates listeners and players for at least another 60 years. Tom Huizinga, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2024 Subaru Crosstrek Wilderness with off-road capability and 9.3 inches of ground clearance designed for adventure seekers. Learn more at Subaru.com/wilderness. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio. KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Coming up next year on KPR, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Just a reminder that our election coverage Tuesday night will begin at 6 o'clock on all KPR One stations. Tune in. Jay Schaefer will be hosting our live election coverage from Kansas Public Radio and NPR.
Do you love public radio but hate the thought of selling your old car, truck, or motorcycle? Donate that vehicle to KPR. It'll be picked up and proceeds from its sale will fund our programs. Learn more at KansasPublicRadio.org.
Guys, with highs in the upper 60s today. We've got a chance of rain returning tonight. Rain very likely in the forecast for tomorrow. This is KPR.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Psychedelic therapy could revolutionize treatment for depression and anxiety. But what if you don't want a mind-blowing six-hour journey, complete with hallucinations and an interior light show? Could you take a psychedelic drug without having to trip?
That is the billion-dollar question. Everything that we're doing, it's all kind of focused on that question.
Meet the neuroscientist trying to create non-hallucinogenic psychedelics.
We can chemically evolve them into something that doesn't look anything like a psychedelic, but will have some of the similar effects on the structure and function of the brain.
Welcome to Luminous, our series on psychedelics. This hour, which one makes you better, the drug or the trip? First this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. 2 days before Election Day, more than 76 million voters have already cast their ballots. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump are trying to win over undecided voters in swing states. Trump will be in Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania today. Harris will be in Michigan after a surprise appearance on Saturday Night Live. NPR's Asma Khalid reports.
This was Harris's first ever appearance on SNL, and it came on the final show before the election. In the sketch, she spoke to the SNL version of Harris, played by Maya Rudolph. Together, wearing matching suits, they riffed on her name.
Because what do we always say? Keep Kamala and carry on a lot.
Many politicians over the years have gone on SNL. In 2015, when Donald Trump was first running for president, he hosted the show. But he's since soured on the program, saying it favors Democrats. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Trump reached out to suburban women yesterday at a rally in Gastonia, North Carolina, a state he's won twice. It has 16 electoral votes. Trump said he thinks women love him.
I will protect our women. I'm going to protect our women.
Later, Trump described Harris as a weak and foolish woman. In advance of Election Day, thousands of women rallied in Washington, D.C. yesterday in support of abortion rights. Reproductive health measures are on the ballots in 10 states. The Biden administration has stepped up efforts to resolve conflicts in Lebanon and Gaza. As NPR's Daniel Estrin reports, Israel is awaiting the U.S. presidential elections as it considers its next moves in the region.
Israel is engaged in three main battles against Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran. Nadav Strauchler, a former political strategist for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, says Netanyahu could have helped the Biden-Harris administration score political points ahead of the election with progress on ceasefires in Gaza and Lebanon. But Netanyahu is first waiting to see if former President Donald Trump, who is Netanyahu's close ally, wins the elections.
I don't see him rushing for a deal until the election. He will wait. So this is something that doesn't help this administration and maybe somehow does help Trump.
The next president will also be a key decision maker on any future Israeli strikes in Iran, potentially targeting its nuclear program. Iran's supreme leader is threatening a, quote, crushing response following Israel's strikes on Iran last week. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The World Health Organization says an Israeli strike injured several Palestinians in northern Gaza yesterday, near a clinic that was given polio vaccinations. The Israeli military says its initial review indicates it was not operating in the area at the time. UNICEF said yesterday more than 50 children were killed in attacks in northern Gaza in recent days. This is NPR News in Washington. In Spain, officials, including the king, visited the flood-ravaged region of Valencia today. They were greeted by angry survivors who shouted killers and shame. Police had to intervene to keep them back. The residents wanted to know why nothing had been done to avoid the tragedy. More than 200 people died in last week's floods that left entire neighborhoods covered in mud. Emergency crews are still combing through underground parking and tunnels for those still missing. Authorities in Uganda said today 14 people were killed by lightning in a refugee camp. Kate Bartley reports they were believed to be mostly children who were attending a church service.
Ugandan police said more than a dozen people died and dozens more were injured when the lightning struck a church during a prayer meeting at the Palabek refugee camp on Saturday evening. The building was a makeshift metallic structure. The refugee camp is in a remote part of northern Uganda near the border with troubled South Sudan. It hosts about 80,000 refugees, mainly from that country. Deadly lightning strikes are not uncommon in the region during the rainy season. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
The New York City Marathon is underway. Organizers say the event attracts more than 50,000 runners from more than 150 countries, including some previous winners and some who had competed in the Paris Olympics and the Paralympics. The 26.2-mile course takes them through all five boroughs of New York. It starts in Staten Island and finishes in Central Park. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org.
As to the best of our knowledge, I'm Ann Strainchamps.
And I'm Steve Paulson. If you've been following the news about psychedelics, you know we may be on the cusp of a revolution in psychiatry. For the first time in decades, promising new treatments for depression and PTSD seem to be just around the corner.
But psychedelic therapy is not going to be like anything we've known before.
When I could feel the medicine taking hold, there was a feeling of like a big feathery wing swooping over me. It was like, ooh. I felt like I was swooning in it.
Blissful highs, but also weird hallucinations.
And the plants were going, me, 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 come pollinate me. And they were talking to the bees, but they were talking to me too.
I felt like I was moving on a conveyor belt into a jungle, and what it was leading to was a huge wasp. And I'm like, oh, I'm going into a wasp.
I suddenly found myself surrounded by these enormous fluorescent serpents that started speaking to me. A kind of telepathic language that went right through my forehead, and the first thing that they said was, you are just a tiny human being. And I could see, looking at them, that they were right. At which point I had to vomit, in fact.
It can all be a little much.
In a sense, I'm grateful I had this experience, but it's totally terrifying. The last thing I remember is that, holy sh**, what have I gotten myself into here?
Frankly, a lot of you may be listening to this and thinking, yeah, no thanks. And speaking as someone who spent more years of my life on antidepressants than off, I might be with you there. I mean, sure, I would like to feel better. But does the treatment have to be quite so epic?
And that's one of the biggest questions about psychedelics today. What if you need the benefits of psychedelic therapy, but you don't actually want the journey that shakes your world inside out? Is there a way to take the drug without the trip?
This is Luminous, our series on the science and philosophy of psychedelics. And this hour, the debate over the drug, the trip, and the future of psychedelic therapy.
So I've been following the development of psychedelic drugs for years, and I've talked with lots of the scientists who've done really groundbreaking research. It's pretty clear these drugs have tremendous potential for treating all kinds of mental disorders. And then last year, I heard about a scientist who's trying to do something that seemed so radical, so counterintuitive, it was hard to fathom.
He's trying to re-engineer psychedelic molecules to remove the trip. And he co-founded a biotech company that's raised well over $100 million to develop these drugs. But still, you have to ask, who wants to take a hallucinogen without the hallucinations? Isn't the trip the whole point? David Olson is a neuroscientist at UC Davis. He's not claiming that a psychedelic journey won't be helpful. He is saying we need to recognize the true scale of the problem.
1 in 5 people will suffer from a neuropsychiatric disease at some point in their lifetime. That's about 1 billion people worldwide.
And psychedelic-assisted therapy, he says, is just not scalable at that level.
It needs to be administered in a clinical setting under the supervision of usually multiple healthcare providers, which drastically increases the cost and the complexity of the treatment. You know, for some people, they're not going to have access to that kind of care. They can't afford to take off the 6 hours of work for their psilocybin session. They may not live near a psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy center. Their insurance might not pay for it.
And even if you manage to get over those hurdles, even in the best-case scenario, a lot of people are never going to get this therapy.
Let's assume that there is a psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy center next to every Starbucks, and let's assume that every insurance company will fully reimburse for it. There are still a lot of patients that will be left out. If you have a co-occurring condition like schizophrenia or a family history of psychosis or dementia, you may not be a great candidate for psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy. Additionally, there are some cardiac risks associated with some of the various psychedelics. And so if you have heart condition, you may be excluded as well. And so I'm concerned that these types of medicines will not be broadly available to the general population.
And there's one other thing.
A lot of people just don't want to have the trip.
That's true.
I mean, the psilocybin trip can be very scary. Even if it's beneficial, it can produce a ton of anxiety. It can make you feel like you're going crazy. It's not for everyone.
Agreed.
There's a big question underlying your research here, and that's if we want the therapeutic benefits of psychedelics to treat some of these disorders like depression and anxiety, I think the operating assumption has been it's all about the experience. It's all about going through this mind-bending trip where you kind of see the world in new ways. You know, you have this new sense of meaning and purpose. You have maybe sort of the sense of being connected with the universe. That's why the therapy works. That's why psychedelics work. You're talking about something totally different here.
Well, there's been a lot of really great research from people like the late Roland Griffiths and others who have demonstrated that a psilocybin experience can be rated by people as being among the most significant experiences in their lives. But if there are other patients that do not need that experience and can get benefit by just having physical changes in the structure of their brains, then that would broaden access to a larger number of people.
And that's why David Olson's trying to engineer new kinds of molecules without the hallucinogenic trip. He says the prefrontal cortex, that part of our brain that regulates our thoughts and actions and emotions, can get out of whack. The neurons atrophy, which can then lead to all kinds of problems, including depression, PTSD, and schizophrenia. So what if you could repair the prefrontal cortex?
The way I would describe it is if you think of a neuron like a tree. Trees have branches that would be like the dendrites of a neuron. And on those branches, there are leaves, and those would be like synapses in a neuron. In a healthy brain, you have a very rich canopy where you have lots of these leaves touching each other so that you have lots of communication between the trees. Squirrels can easily jump from one tree to the other. But in many brain disorders, it looks like wintertime. All the leaves have fallen off, the branches have been pruned back, and now there's not easy access between the two trees. And so what these psychoplastogens seem to do is to rapidly regrow the neuronal arbors and reestablish that synaptic connectivity.
My understanding is this is different than the basic premise of SSRIs, where it's really trying to fix a chemical imbalance. I mean, it's basically trying to give you more serotonin, which will then improve your mood and hopefully treat depression. This is a totally different model that you're talking about.
So SSRIs definitely work for some patients, for sure. But they don't work for all patients. And the other thing about SSRIs is that daily administration paradigm has other disadvantages. If you take any drug every day for a long period of time, it is quite likely that you're going to have some kind of off-target side effects. Things like weight gain, sexual dysfunction are very common with SSRIs, and they can lead some patients to not want to take them for those reasons. And so if we can identify molecules that can do what an SSRI does over the course of 3 weeks, but they can do it after one dose within 24 hours and the effect would last for a month, that would allow patients not only to have a rapid response and a sustained response, but potentially avoid a lot of those undesired side effects.
David has a name for these small molecules, psychoplastogens, the drugs that generate new plasticity within the brain, firing up those synaptic connections that had withered away. So are these essentially like classic psychedelic drugs like psilocybin, but somehow you're just stripping out the hallucinogenic effect? The molecule is actually quite similar?
Yeah, so structurally, that's kind of been our approach, at least at the start. So at the start, we wanted to use molecules that had demonstrated clinical efficacy, like psilocybin, like ketamine, like MDMA, and then just make small tweaks to their chemical structures to remove the hallucinogenic effects. However, the way that medicinal chemistry works, it's a lot like chemical evolution. And by making systematic changes in the structure of the molecule, you can refine it to the various purposes that you're intending. And so if we start with the structures of psychedelics, we can chemically evolve them into something that doesn't look anything like a psychedelic, but will have some of the similar effects on structural neuroplasticity.
Hmm. Is this hard to do? I mean, in the lab, is this like a really complicated process to try to create these molecules and to take out the hallucinogenic properties?
Well, I think this is why medicinal chemists will always have a job. They have job security.
And the medical model here, it's completely different than how psychedelic therapy works right now, which typically involves spending hours and hours with facilitators before, during, and after a trip.
The goal is to create medicines that are safe enough that you can go to the local pharmacy, pick them up, and store them in your medicine cabinet. And how frequently you have to take the pill, whether that's once a week, once a month, once a year, time will tell. But it will not be the traditional SSRI type model. Now you can start thinking about taking one of those drugs and interacting with a therapist in a virtual environment over Zoom or something like that. That would eliminate the need to go to the clinic. But I do imagine that there will be kind of this treatment hierarchy where at the base of this treatment pyramid, you'll start with the most scalable medicines, which will be the take-home drugs, where that's all you need. And if patients get better, fantastic. And if they don't, they can start to move up the pyramid where we append other things like psychotherapy or like an in-clinic hallucinogenic experience.
So far, the research to engineer these psychoplastogens has largely been done on mice, but there's only so much you can learn about a psychedelic drug, hallucinogenic or not, from a mouse brain. And this is where David Olson's biotech company comes in. So let me ask you a little bit about Delix, the company that you have co-founded that is doing this research, developing products. I believe you have over $100 million in venture capital already put into the company, right?
Yes, that's correct. Delix has been very successful in their fundraising efforts to this point.
And what's your timeline? I mean, I realize this is basic research, it's difficult research, but do you have any sense of when you will start to see results or when you might have some drugs that will come on the market?
Yeah, so a lot of people think of Delix as the company that's taken the fun out of fungi. They're the non-hallucinogenic cycloplastogen company. But right now, what's very exciting is they've been able to take the first non-hallucinogenic sample. Now the question is, will it be effective? And honestly, that question will not be answered for a very long time. And so this is going to take years and years of clinical work, very hard clinical work.
How many years, if things go well?
Typical drug discovery is a 20-year process.
Oh, wow.
And we've been moving pretty quickly. So that usually comes from a lot of the preclinical testing all the way through the safety studies, through the phase one, and then you do all of the clinical work. We're hoping it's not going to take us 20 years to get to this, but to get to our first question of efficacy in the first patient population that we're looking at, that should take a few more years.
Now, it seems like a lot is riding on your work. I mean, literally, billions of dollars. The psychedelic industry is booming. It's taking off. There are a lot of startups. This will become, if it's not already, a multi-billion dollar industry. And if we're talking about being able to deliver the therapeutic effects without having to do the big trip, the big experience, that will totally take the psychedelic industry in another direction, correct?
Well, you point out the large figures in dollars, but you have to realize that those dollars come from the large number of patients. We're talking about a billion people worldwide that suffer from some kind of mental illness that might be impacted by psychoplastogenic drugs. That is really what I'm focused on, is trying to reach the largest patient population that we can. Now, psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy is incredible because it's taking the field in a completely new direction, one that is more similar to a healing-based approach than simply mitigating disease symptoms. But if that is the only way to reap the benefit of these molecules, it would be a very, very sad day for this world, because only a subset of very fortunate individuals would be able to access that type of treatment. But with the non-hallucinogenic cycloplastogens, we hopefully can broaden that to the enormous number of people who are impacted by mental health conditions every day.
That's David Olson, director of the UC Davis Institute for Psychedelics and Neurotherapeutics, and also the co-founder of the biotech company Delix Therapeutics.
David's not the only scientist looking for alternatives to SSRIs. Coming up, we'll meet a psychiatrist who got so fed up with standard treatments for depression, he started investigating ancient treatments and discovered most of them induce altered states.
I was like a guy going around retrofitting ancient practices for depression. You can make a list of things that humans have discovered over and over again that are usually used for religious purposes, like sweat lodges, fasting, extreme running, sleep deprivation. Psychedelics were sort of the queen of the ancient practices.
This is Luminous, our series on the science and philosophy of psychedelics. I'm Steve Paulson.
And I'm Ann Strangchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello this afternoon at 2 p.m. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu. And from the Midwest Trust Center at JCCC, presenting Paragon Ragtime Orchestra, Sunday, November 17th at 2 p.m. Their presentation of Meet Me at the Fair is a musical celebration of the world's fairs. More at jccc.edu/mtc. This is KPR.
Billions of people know what it's like to suffer from depression or anxiety, and I'm one of them. So I am very well aware of the benefits of standard SSRI treatments and also of their limitations. Psychedelic-assisted therapy sounds incredibly promising, but then so did Prozac 30 years ago.
So where does that leave psychiatrists and their patients? Chuck Raison is on the front lines of that question. He's one of the leading researchers in the current psychedelic revival. I recently sat down with Chuck in his office at the University of Wisconsin to talk about his research and what it means for treating people with depression. So how do you decide which is better, a psychedelic or an SSRI? Is it even possible to reconcile the two?
That has been one of the impossible goals of my lifetime, is to try to reconcile the perspective on treatment that's implicated by things like psychedelics and the perspective on treatment that's standard in American psychiatry, especially with standard antidepressants. I've never reconciled it. You know, people very often consult with me on patients because I've been doing this for a long time. And I'm always dumbfounded. Somebody's depressed. They've got problems. Should I tell them, why don't you think about going to a legal psychedelic retreat offshore and doing a psychedelic? It's probably going to bring you face to face with your issues. See if you can resolve your issues, right? Or should I say, you know what? You're so depressed. Why don't you start on an SSRI like Prozac or Paxil, and let's just see if we can make you feel better. There's real practical implications of this. I just recently consulted on a case where this woman had tried psychedelics and they had not helped her. Put her back on a regular antidepressant, saved her marriage. So, don't know.
That's not an easy question to answer.
It's
psychedelics versus traditional antidepressants.
It's very, very hard because they're so different, right? The standard antidepressants, we know what they do. They sort of make everything less concerning. You know, they, long before they make you undepressed, and people that are going to help, almost immediately after taking them, you sort of begin to look on the bright side of the street. You don't worry as much. I mean, there's brain imaging studies. They very rapidly turn down the danger center in the brain. And so you wander around for a few weeks feeling better about things. You smile a little bit more and then people smile back at you. That's great. And then the downside of that, of course, though, is that if they chill things out too much, you go flat, you go numb. And that is a major side effect of those agents. People wander around and say, I'm not feeling as horrible, but I'm not feeling as anything. I had a guy say a couple of years ago that his sister went on antidepressants and he felt like he half lost her, that there'd been a depth of feeling that was erased with it, right? So that's the downside there. Now, psychedelics, of course, they are really the opposite. They ramp everything up. They make emotions more salient. I am obsessively fascinated with this dialectic between experience your problems, face your problems, feel your feelings fully, accept the difficulties of life, be grateful that you're alive, versus take a pill, feel better, thank God. It's sort of the difference between face it and change or chill it out and just roll with it.
There's a huge question about why psychedelics are so effective, and is it essentially the biological reaction in the brain? You know, you're injecting these new chemicals, sort of rewiring the brain in some way, or do you need the experience itself? Is the chemical the trigger to really have the experience, and it's the experience that matters? I mean, a lot rides on how you answer that question.
That is the billion-dollar question. That is what animates my work, right? So everything that we're doing, it's all kind of focused on that question.
And let me just mention one other practical implication of that, because I've talked with people in the venture capital startup business, and it seems like the magic bullet there would be to tweak, let's say, the psilocybin molecule, make it fast-acting. You just have 2 or 3 hours minimal experience, but you get all the benefits. You can go into the clinic and you're better, but you don't have to go through all the hard stuff.
Absolutely. And I admire this guy, Dave Olson, so much. Started a company called Delix Therapeutics, trying to take psychedelics, like you say, tweak them even a little harder so that it's not that the experience lasts for an hour or two. It's that you've removed the psychedelic experience. Psychedelics have big direct effects on the brain. You're getting all that big direct effect on the brain, no psychedelic experience. And so you could take the pill at home on Saturday morning and then feel better for 6 months. And when you start feeling kind of bad again in 6 months, you get another pill. And that's the VC, venture capital, pharmaceutical dream, right? Charge $20,000 a pill, you know, no muss, no fuss. It doesn't violate this very impersonal machine-like system we have in place for dealing with mental health in the United States. So people are absolutely after this. And I get accused of being the sort of killjoy, like I'm trying to destroy psychedelic culture. But truly, I'm really rooting for consciousness. I personally am greatly hoping that when we remove the conscious experience, that it will not have the signal. So I'm on the side of consciousness, but my mentor back at Emory told me early on, he said, look, if you're afraid of the truth, just get out of science right now. Science may blow up these things with psychedelics. We'll see.
Well, I know there's another study going on. I don't know what stage it is in, where people are trying to administer psychedelics while you're asleep.
That would be me. Yes. Yes.
So the idea is you'd wake up, you didn't know that you had it, probably had some crazy dreams, though.
Maybe. So everything I'm doing is around the question that you articulated better than me. Is it direct biological effect of the drug that you don't need consciousness for, that the trip is just going along for the ride, so you can maybe get rid of the trip? Or is the experience that's induced by the drug what causes the transformation? And if people say, well, there's no way that an experience could produce a transformation like that, the answer is, well, what about post-traumatic stress disorder, right? So you take people, they're in one state of functioning, they have something shocking, unexpected, horrifying happen to them, and then that thing lives on in them, constantly present, and it totally changes their life, changes their behavior. Well, what is that other than an experience causing a profound change? So there's already a template for the possibility that a shocking, surprising, positive experience, like a psychedelic experience, can produce long-term change.
Have you done this study on the sleep?
So the challenges with the study, we are doing it. We had to produce IV psilocybin, given inside somebody's vein. So it's taken a while, but we're getting close. And then the other thing we have to do is, how do you give it to people while they're asleep and not wake them up? So you got to hook them up to a sleep EEG, and you'd want to give it to them when they're in deep sleep, but you got to sneak in, you got to put the IV needle in, and how do you do that without waking people up? So we've been practicing in the research unit with me as a primary guinea pig. You know, I lay down, I go to sleep, and can they administer it without waking me up? So we don't know about psilocybin yet, because psilocybin, if your heart rate goes up, it may be that every single person that you give it to opens their eyes and says, oh, whoa, right? But nobody's ever tried to give it while people are really deeply asleep. So maybe they'll just sleep. Maybe they'll have dreams. But if you can't figure out how to give it, say, just normal salt water by IV infusion while people are sleeping, you're never going to be able to give that. So we've been working on just the salt water. And so we can do it. And it's really interesting. The way to do it is not what you'd predict. So Stephanie Jones at UW has been the mastermind of this. I would have waited until people were in deep sleep, snuck in as quietly as possible one time and taken a run at it. And she's like, oh, no, that's never going to work. What you have to do is come in every 15 minutes, stand over the people, shake the IV line, and you just keep doing that until people get so used to you coming into the room, standing over the IV and shaking it, that they get deconditioned. And they've now, for several of us, they've been able to do it. But if we can keep, you know, half the people asleep, then we're going to get funded. We've got funding to do this big, big study where half the people will get it awake, half asleep. And that is really interesting.
You know, it strikes me that if it turns out that these kinds of studies determine it isn't biology, it's consciousness, that's what's changing.
Yep.
A lot of startups collapse at that point,
exactly.
Don't they? I mean, their whole premise is they're tweaking the biology of these molecules, and that's how they're going to make their fortune, and that's the future of the psychedelic revolution.
You're right. Because if it turns out that people wake up in the morning, they don't remember anything, and they go, whoa, I'm going to go to the monastery. I feel differently about life. And you talk to them 2 months later, they say, I don't know what it was. Obviously, I don't remember anything, but, you know, my relationships have gotten better. I'm happier. I'm exercising. I've developed a spiritual life. Then the psychedelic community is going to hate me, because I've now shown that the folks that are trying to tweak it and get rid of, you know, knock yourself out, right?
But I still don't understand, putting aside that these questions of blocking the memory or trying to do this while you're sleeping, just the psilocybin experience, let's say, that most people have, why can a single experience from a single dose have such long-lasting effects? 6 months later, a year later, a lifetime later, is that rewiring the brain? Or you just had this experience and somehow the experience has caused you to see the world in a new way?
Right. Unless you're a dualist and think that there is some kind of soul that maybe has been shifted by this. If we just take a purely scientific look at the world, that Consciousness arises from brain function. Your feelings arise from brain function. Your behavior arises from brain function. It has to be the case that if you are different 6 months from now, there's got to be some physical substrate for that difference. What that substrate is, of course, the Holy Grail, right? Everybody wants to know. Steve Paulson, you got a psilocybin experience 3 months ago and you were depressed and now you're feeling great. Chuck Raison, you got a psilocybin experience and you don't feel any different. There's got to be a change in your brain to explain why that happened, and nobody's been able to find it.
Where would you look for that?
Damned if I know. would you look in the frontal lobe where sort of decision-making is done? Would you look in temporal areas that are deeper, kind of ancient emotional areas? I don't know what psychedelics do while you're in the middle of a psychedelic experience. The brain is by far the most complex thing in the universe, and so it's really hard to tell.
Now, there's another huge question, which is related to what we've been talking about, and that's whether you need a mystical experience to have the full therapeutic effects. And there's some debate about what is a mystical experience. I mean, some of the features that are commonly mentioned are there's the sense of oneness with the universe around you. You kind of lose your sense of ego, transcendence of space and time, mm-hmm. feeling that this other reality of the experience is more real than right. your waking reality.
Yes.
Do you need all of that to have this really powerful impact that people often have after a psychedelic experience? Or can you just have sort of a ho-hum experience and get the full benefits?
The mystical experience is, it's certainly the best, most replicated thing that if you have that during the psychedelic experience, you're likely to benefit down the road, weeks and weeks later, less depression, less anxiety. You're not as likely to be drinking, smoking, and all that stuff. But it's not the only thing. So I think there's another domain that is often attached to the mystical experience, but is also clearly separable, that's been called emotional breakthrough, which is closely related to something that you might call psychological insight. These are experiences that have more to do with the sort of life story of the person. So a number of studies have shown that if a person has a psychedelic experience and in that experience they face difficult personal challenges that they usually try to push aside, if they accept things in their lives that really aren't changeable, like, for instance, I'm overwhelmed with horror that I'm dying of cancer, but I realize that I need to accept it. That also pretty strongly in most studies predicts antidepressant response, let's say. So this is psychedelics as a year of psychotherapy in a day, that construct, right? So I actually think that facing one's demons, facing the challenges that one has experienced in life, and looking at the narratives that one is living, I think that is actually, in some ways, more profoundly spiritual. So if we use the word spiritual, because that's about pragmatic personal transformation, right?
So that suggests, if that's the core of the emotional breakthrough, is that you face your demons, it almost by definition has to be a difficult experience then, right?
Correct.
You can't just have a blissful experience and have the emotional breakthrough. I mean, it's a high. It feels fabulous, but it's not going to.
No, it comes at the end of suffering, though. It comes at the end of a tough time. Absolutely. So one of the dangers of psychedelics is that they can encourage something that's been called spiritual bypass, which basically means that you got these very pragmatic, sort of more primitive behaviors, problems, emotions that you're dealing with, and that are causing you trouble in your life. And instead of dealing with them, you just go into the spiritual realm. You go up into the heights. You transcend them. You see this, like when psychedelics go bad, what they often seem to produce are sort of very narcissistic people. These are people wandering around talking about spirituality.
They have met God and they're going to tell you about it.
Absolutely. And then you watch how they're living their lives, though, and there's no evidence that they have met any kind of God that you'd want to have a drink with, certainly, right? So, you know, that's partly why I trust more the spirituality of descent, spirituality down into the roots of suffering. Difficult experiences can often be very beneficial.
Yeah. One final question.
Sure.
And you can either answer this or not answer this. Have you had personal experiences, psychedelic experiences that have shaped your understanding of these drugs?
I will tell you that I have had a legal psychedelic experience someplace where it was legal that definitely shaped my understanding of these things. I had an experience where my dead mother came to me and told me some stuff that I had struggled with out of my childhood. And do I believe she came to me? No, not at all. I don't believe it. Do I undoubtedly feel emotionally that she came to me? Absolutely. So it's interesting. I'll elaborate a little bit. Before you do one of these things, and this was really, it was with a bunch of very high-level mental health practitioners that are interested in working with psychedelics.
What was the drug that you took?
Psilocybin, right? So, you know, beforehand, you talk about, well, what do you want to do? What are you thinking? And I was really thinking I was going to be dealing with my father, who's also dead. So I had no expectation that my mom was going to show up. But boom, you know, I had a thought. This has been a pretty good time in my life. And so I was going, you know, I'm having a bad experience here. This is okay. So what should I do in my life to improve it? And then I said, well, what's keeping me from doing that? I said, well, I'm still struggling with this sort of issue that I was more close with my mom in childhood. My dad kind of got excluded, a classic Freudian thing. And then all of a sudden, here comes my mom, and she's got my dad in tow. And she basically reminded me of something she said to me about how she felt bad about pulling me in to be sort of her therapist when I was a kid. And she said, don't you remember I told you that while I was still alive? You know, I said, oh, yeah, that's right. Back in the 80s, God, you were crying. I kind of suppressed that for some reason, right? And then she said, literally, she said, look, your dad's my problem. You know, we're here in the afterlife. Don't worry about us. We're going to have to go off for a couple of lifetimes to deal with each other. And off they went. But it was so unexpected and so real. And the felt sense was, dang, that was my mom, all right.
Was that difficult, that experience?
No, it was actually very relieving.
So you didn't have to go through sort of the anxiety piece of
the experience? I didn't. So back to your point. No, this was really interesting. I didn't go through the anxiety piece on this. So now I can tell you that this was a while ago. And I probably once a day I think about it. Now I'm curious. Is it still with me? Because we talked about, you know, this is what I research. And yeah, it's still with me. It's really interesting. I felt like I had a final interaction with my mom. And it was so weird and so quirky. It was utterly believable. I totally emotionally believed that they are off in the afterlife trying to figure out their problems and deal with them. Even though I don't actually, sadly, believe in the afterlife. And I don't really believe she came and saw me. But there you go.
Chuck Raison is a psychiatry professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of clinical research for the USONA Institute.
Coming up, another in the you can't make this stuff up category, a clinical psychologist launches a research project on psychedelic healing because the plants told her to.
It was February in New Jersey. I just wanted sunshine and a beach. And I signed up for a retreat in Costa Rica. And the day before I was leaving, I get a phone call that said, do you want to sign up for the ceremonies? And I said, what ceremonies? And it turns out there were a series of ayahuasca ceremonies being offered that week at the retreat center. This was in 2005. I, of course, said yes. At some point after just a few sessions, I was hearing the voice of ayahuasca. And that was a little mind-blowing for me because, you know, I'm not crazy, I didn't think. And I am telling you, it is exactly the same as hearing your voice. The message was, do the research. I'm in a ceremony, I'm under the effects. And I'm like, what? What research? Do the research. And she doesn't say that to everybody. I've never heard anyone else get that message. I went back and called a nationally known researcher. Call him up and I say, Grandmother Ayahuasca told me to do this research. Will you help me? There's this pause on the phone. He's 85 at the time. And he says, yes.
Rachel Harris did the research on ayahuasca and through it discovered an underground network of women elders who provided psychedelic healing to people in need for decades, risking everything to do so. She'll tell us about them after this.
You're listening to Luminous. our series on the science and philosophy of psychedelics. I'm Steve Paulson.
And I'm Ann Strangchamps. If you are just discovering the series, you can listen to lots more interviews in the Luminous podcast feed and on our website at ttbook.org/luminous. From To the Best of Our Knowledge on Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. We're online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from F.W. Houston Medical Center, serving Jefferson County and beyond, now accepting applications for a certified dietary manager. Details at fwhuston.com/careers. And from Bob Schwartz Financial, Kansans helping Kansans achieve their financial goals for over 45 years. More information available at bobschwartzfinancial.com. Cloudy skies for the rest of this morning. Highs today in the upper 60s. A 50% chance of showers tonight. A nearly 100% chance of rain tomorrow. It's 66 and cloudy in Lawrence. This is KPR.
We have heard so much about the psychedelic renaissance, about new clinical trials and lab research. Sometimes it's hard to remember that taking psychedelics for any reason is still illegal.
But there's a long tradition of underground guides who work with plant medicines, who talk about unseen beings and plants as teachers.
Rachel Harris is a retired clinical psychologist. She took ayahuasca as part of traditional healing ceremonies in Costa Rica and then found her way to an underground network of psychedelic healers, most of them women.
And now she's written a book based on a series of in-depth conversations with them. It's called Swimming in the Sacred, Wisdom from the Psychedelic Underground. I reached her at her home on an island off the coast of Maine.
Well, you know, the ayahuasca book brought me in contact with some of the underground elders. And they were at a point where they were finally, after decades, ready to go a little bit public, but carefully and anonymously. Many of them are in their 70s. They are still working underground. So they need to be protected. But they wanted their voices heard in this so-called psychedelic renaissance. They have more experience than anyone else in the Western world. Certainly the shaman and indigenous communities have centuries of experience and lineages. But in the Western world, they have more experience than the researchers, for instance. And the researchers were really dominating the psychedelic renaissance. And the women had a different perspective that I felt was being overlooked and could easily be lost.
You describe these women as spiritual warriors. You say they're priestesses and shamans. And even though you've had a lot of psychedelic experiences yourself, you've worked for years as a clinical psychologist, you say you are not like these women. Can you explain that?
You know, things get a little challenging during ceremonies. These women have taken every medicine at every dose. I remember talking to one of the women, and she said, she's early 70s now. She said, well, as I've gotten older, I realize I don't need as much. It's very easy for me to travel. But sometimes, you know, I still like to fly and take a big dose is what she means. And I'm thinking, No, that's really, I don't really need to fly. I'm a scaredy cat. Also, when they're sitting with people, they know the territory. They've been everywhere, and they don't get scared.
What would you be scared about? Where are they going when it gets really difficult?
You know, listen, there are risks with these medicines. The thing that people often report that is the most scary is, I'm never going to come back. I've damaged my brain. I'm going to go crazy, and I'll never be okay again. And if you talk to any of the elders, not just the ones I interviewed, but across the board, everybody knows someone who was harmed and was never quite the same again. There is a risk. It's very, very small. Every drug has a risk and challenging side effects. So that's what I would be afraid of. One of the elders told me this story. She's very experienced, a very serious person. And she's sitting with someone, and I'm not quite sure what happened. But she said, I realized I had to take him to the emergency room. So that means she has to walk into a hospital ER and confess what she's been doing, which is illegal. She goes in with him. He gets some medication, and the doctor is sympathetic, so he doesn't call the police.
Yeah.
But that was just pure luck.
And we should make this point. I mean, what they are doing is illegal. To do this kind of work involves risks, including potentially ending up in jail.
They risked everything. And I asked them why. They had, you know, above ground jobs. They had regular jobs. And they said, these medicines helped me so much, I couldn't not work with people and help them.
Why did you choose to just talk with these women elders? Why not male elders as well?
My personal response, honestly, is I've listened to men for 50 years. It's enough already, to be honest about it. But I felt that the women had more of a relationship with the medicines, more of a personal relationship with what I call unseen others. So plant spirits or ancestors or angels, they had a relationship with beings that we can't see that. They were more connected in that way with other worlds.
Can you talk more about that? These unseen beings? Who are these entities?
Well, we don't really know, do we? I mean, you know, this is an unresearchable question in terms of Western research. And that's the whole process of indigenous training, having the plant spirit become an ally who will help you. Because the elder women work with the medicines throughout a whole lifespan. They have people come into them once a year to do a journey, all the way through their whole life. Maybe they bring their partner, their spouse. I've sat in ayahuasca ceremonies with three generations of a family.
So these women might be working with the same people for years.
For years.
Maybe even for decades?
Huh. For years.
Wow.
I mean, that's how the underground has worked with medicines, not in this 3-month cost-effective treatment approach that's designed to reduce symptoms. Women have worked with people over a lifetime for their own personal growth and evolution.
When you talk about unseen helpers and angels and plant spirits, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are thinking, this is getting pretty woo-woo here.
She had a research background.
Really stretching believability. Does that skepticism bother you?
Well, it's been a process that I've written about in my books because, yes, it drove me crazy. And gradually, my worldview, my own personal cosmology, has been shifting a little bit so that I've become a little bit more fluid. But I've been a difficult case. You know, I'm raised in the Western world.
Well, and the other question is, if you feel like you have some sense of this otherworldly presence, or you're hearing a voice, is that coming from outside you, or is that a projection of something within yourself? It seems like that's a pretty important question.
Yes, you think we have an answer for that?
I don't know.
I think that's the most difficult question, the inner-outer question.
So the women you talk to, these women who've been working in the psychedelic underground for all these years, obviously have just a radically different method and protocol than the university researchers, the scientists who were running the clinical trials. And I'd like to sort of unpack those differences. It seems like maybe the goals are different in some way. I mean, the clinical trials are typically focused on specific treatments for different mental disorders, depression, addiction, PTSD. Do the women elders you talk to, do they tend to focus on specific problems like that, or are the goals different?
Totally different. The research studies have selected very sympathetic diagnoses to look at. People who have suffered with PTSD, veterans for suffering for decades. The women are not therapists. They don't think in terms of a cost-effective approach to reducing symptoms. They're looking for transformation. So they hold the medicines in a much bigger container. and far more spiritual.
Don't the university scientists also want transformation?
Well, how much transformation can you see after just a few weeks?
I don't know. I mean, that's the question. But isn't the goal? I mean,
but they're not following them up enough to really see how has their life changed. Because the therapy sessions are a big cost. They're a big expense in the research protocol.
Right.
So they do three, maybe four at the most, kind of debriefing, what they call integration sessions. Many of the subjects have said they need more. But there's an ongoing unfolding and process in life after a journey. The women are looking for changes in the person's attitude toward their life. I mean, they're really looking at what do the people they work with, what do they bring back to their community? How do they change their lives so that they can contribute and make a difference? How to live on this earth and be joyful. That's not symptom reduction. That's much bigger.
The whole business of being credentialed is another major question in this psychedelic revival that we're in right now, because it's not at all clear who gets to call themselves a psychedelic therapist or a guide. The women you talk to, they don't have medical degrees, I'm assuming.
Correct. So most of them don't.
Yeah. What is their process of training and developing expertise?
You know, one of the women said, here's the question to ask someone who's putting themselves out as a psychedelic therapist. Who authorized you to serve this medicine? This is a lineage question.
As in, you are an apprentice and you should be working with someone with essentially a master?
Exactly. And the women did that for years and years, and they were supervised. Here's the example from someone who trained with a Shipibo shaman. She's the only one who really trained with a Shipibo shaman. But she said, after 6 years working with the shaman says to her, you're ready to sing. The singing is done in the ceremonies, the Icaros. It's a big deal. It's a major part of the healing process. She said, no, I'm not ready. So she sat next to him in ceremonies, and he would sing. She knew the Icaros. She would sing a nanosecond right behind him. So they could compare what they're seeing in the patient and how the Icaros is working, what's changing as they're singing. She did that for a year, and then she started doing ceremonies on her own and singing. So it's quite a process to be able to do that.
Yeah. You say we don't have a word for what these women elders do.
Not really. In our culture.
Yeah. Do we need a word for them?
You know, I'm hoping that we go into a learning mode with these medicines, not a manipulative mode, but that we have the humility to say, these medicines have a lot to teach us. How do we learn how to use them in the most beneficial, safest way? One cognitive scientist, an Israeli, talked about ayahuasca is a school, that it's a process of learning. And I think culturally, that would be a good mode for us to be in.
That's Rachel Harris, a psychologist who's been in private practice for 40 years. Her book is called Swimming in the Sacred, Wisdom from the Psychedelic Underground.
You're listening to Luminous, our series on the science and philosophy of psychedelics. You'll find more interviews on our website at ttbook.org/luminous, and I hope you'll subscribe to the Luminous podcast feed.
To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced in Madison, Wisconsin by Shannon Henry Kleiber, Charles Monroe Kane, Angelo Bautista, and Mark Rickers.
Our technical director and sound designer is Joe Hartke, with help from Sarah Hopeful. Additional music this week comes from Epitome Zero and Floating Spirits.
I'm Steve Paulson.
And I'm Ann Strangechamps. Thanks for listening, and come back often. Come back now. We've got another hour of To the Best of Our Knowledge coming up here on Kansas Public Radio. Don't go anywhere. From the University of Kansas, we're KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5,
KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from In Equatoria. Andrew Sherwood, PhD, Jungian analyst. C.G. Jung suggested that dreams are intentional messages from the unconscious that, when interpreted correctly, provide balance and guidance in life. More at workingwithdreams.com.
Cloudy skies for the rest of this afternoon. We have a 50% chance of rain, 100% chance of rain for tomorrow. It's 66 degrees in Topeka. This is KPR.
It's to the best of our knowledge. Do you remember what it felt like to read when you were young? When a book could be a portal to another world, as real or realer than this one?
The Search for Delicious by Natalie Babbitt.
White Fang by Jack London.
Mark Twain, and more specifically, Huckleberry Finn.
I'm Ann Strangchamps. Most of us have strong memories of the books we fell in love with first. Maybe because we were still new to reading, or maybe because children's books do something special.
I think children's books allow themselves to be hopeful. In some ways, I think of people who write for children as taking upon themselves the job to become a hunter of hope, somebody who captures hope and puts it on the page and sends it out into the world.
This hour, Reading While Young. First this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Tens of millions of voters have already cast ballots, and with 2 days to go before Election Day, Democrat Kamala Harris and Republican Donald Trump are trying to win over undecided voters. Trump went looking for those voters in Virginia this weekend, where polls show Harris with a comfortable lead. Jad Khalil from Virginia Public Media reports.
Virginia is considered a blue state, but thousands of people packed into a civic center in the state's conservative Southwest.
This is a lot of people. What's going on with Virginia?
Trump claimed he could win Virginia, which he lost in 2020 by 10 percentage points. And he said, without citing evidence, ballot irregularities kept him from winning even bluer states, like California.
If we had an honest election in California, we would win California.
Trump lost in California to Biden by 30 percentage points, or 5 million votes. Trump also repeatedly said the current administration, quote, broke the economy, and only he can fix it. For NPR News, I'm Jad Khalil in Salem, Virginia.
Vice President Harris's campaign has debuted a closing TV spot, a positive ad in which she pledges to be a president for all Americans. But the real message of the ad might be more in where and when it's airing. NPR's Eric McDaniel has more.
First, sports news. The Packers play the Lions on Sunday, an NFL matchup expected to draw millions and millions of viewers in Green Bay, in Detroit, and throughout the swing states of Wisconsin and Michigan. And the Harris campaign believes that putting this ad in front of Sunday NFL fans is a good way to reach Americans who are less than tuned in to the election. Here's Harris campaign chair Jen O'Malley Dillon in a call with reporters Saturday, speaking about undecided voters.
We still know there's some left, and we want to make sure we are the last people that voters are hearing from before they go vote.
The ad shows, in part, Harris speaking directly to viewers, asking for their support. Eric McDaniel, NPR News.
Harris took a break from the battleground states last night to go on to New York to appear on Saturday Night Live. She appeared with Harris impersonator actor Maya Rudolph in matching suits. Harris told her, "You got this." At least six people were injured and nearly 100,000 are without power following a damaging spate of tornadoes in central Oklahoma early this morning. Robbie Gorth from member station KOSU has more on the story.
The National Weather Service issued more than a dozen tornado warnings overnight Saturday into early Sunday. The severe weather ripped through parts of Oklahoma City and leveled buildings nearby. Strong winds flipped vehicles and downed trees and power lines, leading to tens of thousands of outages. Further complicating recovery efforts was the sheer amount of rain, which led to flooding. Some communities received almost 5 inches from the storms. For NPR News, I'm Robbie Korth in Oklahoma City.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Authorities in Uganda said today that 14 people were killed when lightning struck a church in a remote refugee camp yesterday. 34 others were injured. The camp in northern Uganda houses mainly refugees from war-torn South Sudan. They were attending a prayer service in a makeshift metallic structure when the lightning struck. Voters in the former Soviet Republic of Moldova are back at the polls today for a second round of a presidential runoff election. The winner could determine whether the country will pursue deeper ties with the West or return to Russian influence. NPR's Charles Maines reports.
The first round of voting saw pro-Western incumbent President Maia Sandu lead a deep bench of candidates but failed to clear a 50% hurdle for outright victory. She now faces a runoff against a Socialist Party challenger who's calling for better ties with Moscow. The earlier vote was overshadowed by accusations of Russian-backed ballot rigging and disinformation. President Sandu argues Russian pressure undermines support for her candidacy and a referendum on whether to enshrine Moldova's desire to join the European Union into the Constitution. The ballot measure ultimately passed, but by the thinnest of margins. Moscow has denied any attempt to interfere in the outcome. Charles Maines, NPR News.
Officials in Spain, including the king and the prime minister, visited the Valencia region today, 5 days after devastating floods that killed more than 200 people. They were met by angry residents who pelted them with mud and shouted insults for failing to respond quickly to the disaster. Police had to step in to keep back the crowd. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strangehamps. Some of us have been having trouble reading lately. It's like the pleasure, the magic, is gone. Writer Catherine Rundell has a solution.
COVID-19 variants spread across the U.S.
We're in the middle of a global pandemic, and I think you should be reading children's books right now. Children's books are books that traffic in hope and in possibility. They're books which give you a sense of the world as being colossal. Children's books say to you, hope matters, love matters. Children's books will not ever pontificate or self-congratulate because children will not wait while they do so. Children's books have to be a distillation. They are a distillation of our most vulnerable heart, of our hopes and of our dreams. They're a kind of literary vodka. And right now, in the middle of a pandemic, I think we have never needed literary vodka more.
Remember what it felt like when a book could sweep you away in the very first sentence? Catherine Rundell writes books like that, adventure stories for children. She's also a literary scholar at All Souls College, Oxford, and she believes that no matter how old and wise you think you are, you should be reading children's books. And I totally agree.
So I write adventure stories, often unlikely adventure stories, where children are sent on wild quests. And so Rooftoppers is about a girl who discovers that her mother, who she thought had drowned in a shipwreck, might in fact be in Paris. And so she discovers a gang of children who live up on the rooftops of Paris, this wild secret life, and they shoot pigeons with bows and arrows and leap from rooftop to rooftop. So this is just the opening of it. On the morning of its first birthday, a baby was found floating in a cello case in the middle of the English Channel. It was the only living thing for miles, just the baby in some dining room chairs and the tip of a ship disappearing into the ocean. There had been music in the dining hall, and it was music so loud and so good that nobody had noticed the water flooding in over the carpet. The violins went on soaring for some time after the screaming had begun. Sometimes the shriek of a passenger would duet with a high C. The baby was found wrapped for warmth in the musical score of a Beethoven symphony. It had drifted almost a mile from the ship and was the last to be rescued. The man who lifted it into the rescue boat was a fellow passenger and a scholar. It is a scholar's job to notice things. He noticed that it was a girl, with hair the colour of lightning and the smile of a shy person. Think of nighttime with a speaking voice, or think how moonlight might talk, or think of ink if ink had vocal cords. Give those things a narrow, aristocratic face with hooked eyebrows and long arms and legs, and that is what the baby saw as she was lifted out of her cello case and up into safety. His name was Charles Maxim, and he determined, as he held her in his large hands, at arm's length as he would a leaky flower pot, that he would keep her.
Oh, my God, that's so great. You had me at baby floating alone on the ocean. And that reminded me, I guess it's like rule number one for a children's book author, or at least a writer of adventure stories. The first thing you have to do is get rid of the parents, right?
Right. So this is the thing, that parents impose the imperatives of the adult world. And how can you go on an adventure when your parents are saying, make sure you call me by 5 p.m. and be home for supper?
But I think one reason that that can speak to us at any age is that we often all have the feeling as we move through life of being alone, or of finding ourselves sort of adrift or abandoned in the adult world as well as the children's world.
I think it's exactly that. I think we know what it is to feel powerless as adults. When we write about orphans, we write about children who navigate the world in the knowledge of their vulnerability. And I think what you're doing when you write orphans is you're telling adults as well what is left of us when we are stripped away, when we need to start out all over again. That's why so many children's books are about things like fundamental kindness, love, passion, and people who rise to swing for those to whom they are not connected by blood.
Just listening to you talk, I'm thinking about how many children's books are suffused with this, well, you write about it as a hunger for moral justice. You know, I'm thinking about how many classic children's books there are that have somebody evil who's punished, you know, whether it's Captain Hook or Cruella de Vil or Cinderella's stepmother who goes down. There's a sense that the bad people will be punished.
Absolutely. I think a lot of that comes from the germ of children's books, which lies in fairy tales. We want the baddies to go falling through the air and be devoured by their own rage and fury and to be beaten. The idea that we have of fairy tales as a girl in a beautiful dress marrying a prince over and over again, it's entirely recent, really dates to the last 1800 years. And in the 19th century, Giambattista Basile's version of Cinderella, she marries the prince and she goes back to the wicked stepmother with a trunk full of clothes. And she says, I forgive you. I love you. I've brought you these clothes. And the wicked stepmother leans in to look at the clothes and Cinderella slams down the lid and chops her head off. And, you know, that is often what fairy tales really were. They have this kind of grittiness, a kind of darkness. They have blood in them and they have a completely unabashed acknowledgement of our darkest desire. And I love that about them.
Yeah. Isn't there an Icelandic version also where somebody winds up eating somebody else?
Yes. In the Icelandic version, the evil stepmother is an ogress, and she makes her ogress daughter cut off her toes in order to deceive the prince and put on the shoe. And then when he finds out, he kills the ogress daughter, and he makes her into porridge, and he feeds her to the wicked stepmother, which again, for some reason, Disney didn't go with that particular option. Like, we'll never know why.
Yeah, just think what we're all missing. Well, and that's the other thing I think that children's books, the best of them, can do is reconnect us to something primal. The most powerful instincts, hunger and justice and searching and adventure. And I think, you know, that if there's a tragedy of adulthood, it's that we grow up, we become free in the world and powerful in a way that every child dreams of being. And then we discover somehow we live in this world that feels completely flat.
I think exactly that children's books can sometimes be the antidote to that, to the sense that it is naive to hunger for justice. Or maybe more importantly, that it's naive to imagine the possibility of a better world. Children's books stand fundamentally against that belief. So for instance, Le Guin, I remember, I'm just looking for this quote, she said, "We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. So did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art, and very often in our art, the art of words." So she believed that her books might be something that would sow the seeds that are necessary for resistance.
Wow. Now you're painting a picture of children's books as politically subversive also, as having kind of a deep element of anti-establishmentarianism.
I think that's absolutely true. Some of them. It's very important to acknowledge that huge numbers of children's books, especially British children's books, have suggested that the best thing you can be is quiet, white, thin, rich, and profoundly acceptable according to the lights of the day. So they have not always been a tool for rebellion, but it is true that many children's books were also a little bit subversive. They had a surprising politics to them.
Going back to your Roofwalkers book and some of the other adventure stories, you seem like a very adventurous person. I mean, you've been taking trapeze flying lessons.
Oh, that was so much fun. So that would be the best example of doing something that you wouldn't necessarily do otherwise for research and then falling in love with it. So I was writing a book called The Good Thieves, which is a heist set in 1920s New York City with four children, and they all need individual skills. So there's a lockpick and an animal tamer and a boy who is a great trapeze artist. And so I wanted to know what it felt like to fly and to be caught midair. So I took quite a few trapeze lessons. I did land on my face very badly at one point. I went blind in one eye for half a day.
Oh, my God.
But I know, it was a little bit dramatic, but it was worth it. It was a delight.
Did you keep on with the lessons after that, or did you decide, okay, I know enough?
I kept going. The flying trapeze, I cannot recommend it too highly. You just feel a little bit like you're flying, and you feel so elegant, and then someone shows you a video and you realize you do not look elegant. You look like a sort of badger on a fishing line, but the idea is still there.
And then I also read that before you wrote The Explorers, the one set in the Amazon, you learned to fly off a small plane.
I was going to do that anyway, because a lot of my family were pilots in the Second World War, and my uncle was a bush pilot. So when I would go back to visit my family in Zimbabwe, I was learning to fly this tiny little yellow two-seater Piper Cub. And I got quite far with that, such that by the end of my lessons, I could take off and I could fly in the middle quite well. And I very, very bad at landing, which is not at all the way around that you want it.
See, reading those things about you, I found that just remarkable and exciting. And it gave me some of the same sense that life can be an adventure that I get from reading children's books. So my theory in my head is that reading children's books is a way to remember what it felt like to be learning things, how that feeling of learning something is connected to the feeling of adventure and the feeling of possibility in the world. And I think as adults, sometimes we forget to learn. You know, we have the feeling that we grew up and we moved through the various stages of education and then graduated into adulthood. And yeah, I think learning reawakens the child in all of us.
I'm so sure you're right. I've never actually thought of it in that specific way, but of course that makes perfect sense. And also the way they say that the way to make time slow down, if you feel like your life is flashing by in a blur, the best way to make it slow, to grab hold of it again, is to learn something new. And I think there is a great liberation in, as an adult, deciding to learn something, even if you're quite rubbish at it at first, because I think as adults, we become used to being quite good at what we do.
And I think I have taught myself to be willing to be really bad at something for a long time. And that has been an enormous pleasure. The first time I landed an aeroplane, sort of by myself, I said to my instructor who sits behind you, you know, how did I do? And he said, well, technically, only technically, no one died. I was like, oh, thank you. I said, I'm not really a compliment. But, you know, these things, there is such joy in doing something and discovering it, even if the discovery is slow and painful.
That's Catherine Rundell. She is who I want to be when I grow up, or grow young. Her children's books include Rooftoppers, The Good Thieves, and a book-length essay, Why You Should Read Children's Books, Even Though You Are So Old and Wise. And that's the case we're making with this entire hour. And here's another reason why. You know that we talk a lot with writers on this show. And at the end of interviews, we often ask them to recommend a book. Something they've loved, something that's been important to them. You'd be surprised how often it's a children's book.
My name is Quan Barry, and I'm the author of We Ride Upon Sticks. And the book that I'd like to talk about that affected me quite a bit as a writer is White Fang by Jack London. I have to admit, I haven't read White Fang probably since I read it when I was in seventh grade. I was 11 years old. I have this memory of sitting in the house that I grew up in as a child. I had my own bedroom. It was tiny. It had a red rug. And I have this memory of lying on the floor on my stomach reading White Fang for seventh grade English. For those of you who don't know, so White Fang, basically very similar to Call of the Wild. It's a book about a dog in the Yukon or somewhere in Alaska, you know, and the adventures that this dog has. The thing, though, that I remember, and again, I was 11 years old many, many years ago, like more than 30 years ago, like 35 years ago or so, I was, you know, this is when I read this book. I have a memory, though, that it was the first book that made me cry when I finished it. I can't even tell you what happened at the end. Like, I barely remember. I'm like, does he live or die? Or I don't even know. Or I think White Fang might, not to be a spoiler, but it might be the kind of thing like Son of White Fang goes on, you know, that kind of thing. But I don't really remember. But I just remember crying. And I didn't realize that literature could do that to you, that you could read something and then like cry about it. It was such a new experience to me. So it's interesting that I remember that. I don't even remember the story itself. I just remember my reaction to it. And that's the reason why it stayed with me all these many years.
That's poet and novelist Quan Barry. You know, we actually have a whole separate micro podcast called Bookmarks, which now includes an entire section of writers on Kids Lit. You can download the collection at ttbook.org/bookmarks and keep listening because we'll sample a few more this hour. I'm Ann Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from Topeka's Noto Arts and Entertainment District, featuring a celebration of souls, Day of the Dead in southern Mexico, exploring the Dia de los Muertos holiday, traditions, and origins, now through December 14th. Information at explorenoto.org. This month's KPR Community Spotlight is on Americana Music Academy, offering lessons, workshops, and concerts featuring the Music America plays, including folk, jazz, classical, and more. Details at AmericanaMusicAcademy.com. This is Kansas Public Radio.
Children's books get dated, just like everything else. And sometimes, when you go back to one that you loved as a kid, you're in for a nasty shock. Babar That sweet story about an elephant who wears a dapper green suit and visits the opera. Today it reads like a colonialist fantasy with racist illustrations. Huckleberry Finn, the story about the adventures of two runaways on a raft in the Mississippi River. It's so full of racial stereotypes and more than 100 uses of the N-word that it's banned in a lot of schools. So having fond memories of a book can be complicated.
I'm Enrique Salmon. I'm a professor of American Indian Studies at California State University, East Bay. And I've also written the book Eating the Landscape, and I have a book coming out right now about American Indian ethnobotany called Uigara. When I was growing up, I couldn't really read or write or speak English very well up until like 11th grade. It's amazing I even made it to 11th grade. And then there was a teacher, an English teacher, Mrs. Anderson, who decided she was going to bring me up to speed with regards to being able to read and write in English. And she introduced me to Mark Twain, and more specifically, Huckleberry Finn. And I remember working my way through Huckleberry Finn and reading about Huck and Jim and the Mississippi River and all of those things. It really had this impact on me as a person of color, of how people from different ethnic backgrounds can just be friends in that space along the Mississippi River in this area that was actually very racist. I can understand where people are coming from with the use of the N-word that Mark Twain used, but I look at it from the perspective that Mark Twain was writing in a period and from a perspective emerging from his own experience. He never says if he liked or disliked the word. It was just that was his experience and the fictional character's experience. And we have to acknowledge that, that experience and be mindful that, cultures and people change through time, and today we realize that that word is not acceptable anymore, and we have to respect that as well. That book led me to other Mark Twain books. It led me to Hemingway and The Old Man and the Sea. It led me to Steinbeck and to Faulkner, and ever since, I've just had this incredible fascination with books and with reading, and to the point where, I'm a writer myself, and that's the power of a 11th grade English teacher, taking it upon herself to teach a young native guy to read and write through Mark Twain.
Enrique Salmon is the author of Eating the Landscape and Uigara, about American Indian ethnobotany. And that's one of the essays you can hear in our separate Bookmarks podcast, now featuring writers on reading while young. You can hear them all at ttbook.org/bookmarks. We're talking today about reading kids' books, as children and also as adults. And I have to say, I got through the pandemic by reading YA fantasy books. Not just any YA fantasy, a specific subgenre, warrior girls. Girls who carry swords or wands or both. Ninja girls, fey girls. Girls who are secretly werewolves or assassins, who can call up fire and ice, melt minds, kill darkness. Girls who bring down kingdoms. Now, if their fierceness and strength and magical abilities got me, a 60-year-old woman, through the pandemic, imagine what they do for real girls. And now imagine growing up without them. Being told every time you reached for a book about an enchanted land or a kid on a magical quest, those books aren't for you. Here's Ebony Thomas.
There is no magic. This statement, perhaps most famously attributed to Harry Potter's uncle, Vernon Dursley, is also something that my mother has said to me since I was a child. The eldest daughter of an African-American working-class Detroit family, I was born in the late 1970s, just as the fires of the civil rights era were smoldering to ashes. My mother was doing me a favor by letting me know that magic was inaccessible to me. The real world held trouble enough for young black girls, so there was no need for me to go off on a quest to seek it. I was warned against walking through metaphoric looking glasses, trained to be suspicious of magic rings, and assured that no gallant princes were ever coming to my rescue. The existential concerns of our family, neighbors, and city left little room for Neverlands, Middle Earths, or Fantasias. In order to survive, I had to face reality. My life has been intentionally constructed to prove my mother's words wrong.
Ebony Thomas became a writer herself of fan fiction, YA fiction, and a study of race and imagination called the dark fantastic. To explain how black girls have to fight their way into magical fiction, she points to the ongoing debate about a character everyone knows, Hermione Granger. In stage productions of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, Hermione's black, but in the books, her skin color's never mentioned. J.K. Rowling has said she loves black Hermione, but is that how she wrote her? Charles Monroe Kane put the question to Ebony Thomas.
So, was Hermione black?
This is an unpopular opinion, but in the original books, no, she was not black. I don't want to rain on the parade of young black women who insisted that she was black.
You know, I spent hours on the internet last night looking into this, and there are a lot of black scholars, and especially young black women, who are arguing that Hermione is black. This seems like people really care about this issue.
Well, I do think that readers and viewers and audiences can revise our opinions over time. I think that's perfectly valid. So here's the thing. When I was in Harry Potter fandom, I did not see Hermione as black because I could not unmake my late Generation X reality to place a black girl protagonist in a white British author's fantasy blockbuster. I just could not. That world was not a world that I grew up in, came of age in, or existed in. So that's where I was initially. Then in the early to mid 2010s, as millennial women came of age,
yep,
who had grown up with Harry Potter, they read themselves into Hermione because they came of age with slightly more representation.
Mm-hmm.
I think having your childhood in the 90s was quite different than having your childhood in the 70s or 80s. So if you grew up in the 90s and the 00s, then of course you could open up Harry Potter and read yourself into Hermione's character. Growing up, Hermione was a mirror of me. She had bushy hair. She was smart. She was black.
So millennials, they read themselves into the story.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? I mean, these same millennials now are the folks that are the protagonists of Black Lives Matter.
Absolutely.
Did something happen?
Absolutely. Let me tell you what happened. The internet happened. The social web happened. And I really think that is the hard line between Generation X and Millennials. So I was born in 1977, and it would have been impossible for me to experience a 2000s childhood. My childhood in the 1980s, so I was 3 through 13 from 1980 to 1989, I had no access at all to the internet, to streaming television, and until 1988, we had no cable.
Right.
That is a Generation X childhood, period. My childhood and my ideologies are much closer to my aunt and uncle. My youngest aunt and uncle were born in the late 60s. We had almost the same childhood experiences, the same culture, because it's not some magic marketing thing. So I know people market to generations, but it really is about your space time. Mm-hmm. And in the space time I came of age in, we were siloed. So here is the difference, Charles, I'll tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the difference. If I thought Hermione was black in 1985, or if I thought Alice was black, Anne of Green Gables was black, Meg Murray was black, I would have had that thought. And everything around me would have invalidated that thought, from schooling to television to movies. It would have been like, okay, that's a silly thought.
So it's fascinating if you think about it. We have a group of black girls who think Hermione is black. It's like a validation of their imagination, which I think is amazing.
Yeah, I do too.
So how do we get from Hermione to Black Lives Matter? And I think, you know, more importantly, where do we go from here?
I am so excited about this rising generation of young black women. So we have this idea that black kids can't read or they don't read well. But what I am theorizing is that perhaps we don't know how they read. So, for instance, I'm saying, no, Hermione's not black, because I was carefully taught to know that, you know, a Hermione would not be black in the 20th century. The book wouldn't be published. The publisher would say, nobody's going to read a book about a little black girl in magic school. That's exactly what they said to thousands of would-be authors as they rejected manuscripts. So if a child who is 10 reads Hermione as black into the text, or reads Hermione in Harry Potter as black, she grows up and learns that, no, people don't think that you are the protagonist. They think that you're the black best friend. They see you as the help. They see you as the mule. They see you as someone who is supposed to set yourself aside and voluntarily put yourself on the margins. Then there's going to be dissonance between what you imagined your reality would be and what reality is. And so what we're seeing now is a global generation of kids. Yes, young black women, but a global generation of folks who are determined to make these new worlds, or as Langston Hughes said, to make the world anew, because they are refusing their place. I take heart in this new generation, because they are setting this world on fire in the best of ways.
You know, after finishing your book, and I've been thinking about this for days, and maybe it's odd in the context of what we're talking about, but what is imagination?
That's a really good question. And I have defined the imagination gap, because I talk about there being a gap between what we imagine is possible for children of color, particularly black children, and the boxes we put them in. But imagining itself is sort of like dreaming wide awake.
So is it a good idea that we dream wide awake? I mean, according to your mom, what she said.
Well, I think that we have to, right? So I feel as if, as a society, we're in denial about sort of the politics of the imagination. I was really influenced by Claudia Rankine's idea of the racial imaginary. So I think that everything that happens in the desert of the real, to quote, you know, the Matrix trilogy, has some analogy in the unreal, or, you know, so before you do something, you can often imagine yourself or see yourself doing it or anticipating it before.
Right.
So that's why we have to think about imagination. We have to think about dreaming wide awake. And the way out is just this generation of folks who are just really demanding change all over the globe, and who are wanting a new 21st century world.
Well, the powers that be better be careful of the stories they let us tell. They're paying for it now, aren't they?
Ebony Thomas, talking with Charles Monroe Kane. Her book, The Dark Fantastic, Race and the Imagination from Harry Potter to the Hunger Games won the British Fantasy Award for Nonfiction. Coming up, meet Black Girl Magic Personified, writer L.L. McKinney and her dark version of Wonderland. I'm Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're live, we're local, we are Kansas Public Radio from the University of Kansas. We're 91.5 Lawrence and 99.5 Manhattan. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from the Lead Center, welcoming the classical trio of Edgar Meyer, Tessa Lark, and Joshua Roman, performing on bass, violin, and cello this afternoon at 2 o'clock. Tickets are at lead.ku.edu. Cloudy skies throughout the KPR listening area. We still have showers and thunderstorms returning later today. Highs this afternoon in the upper 60s. A 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms overnight tonight. A nearly 100% chance of more rain in the forecast for tomorrow. It's 66 degrees in Lawrence, 67 in Topeka. This is KPR.
L.L. McKinney is a YA writer with some serious superpowers of her own. Her Nightmareverse novels are on the bestseller list, with the TV rights optioned. She's just finished a YA graphic novel about Wonder Woman's twin sister, Nubia. It's DC Comics' first Black woman superhero. And she's writing Marvel's Black Widow. It's kind of like she's single-handedly giving us the magical Black heroines of the future, the ones we've been waiting for. Steve Paulson sat down with L.L. McKinney to talk about where it all started, with A Blade So Black, an urban fantasy version of Alice in Wonderland, in which Alice is a teenage Black girl from Atlanta whose job is killing monsters, a.k.a. nightmares.
Well, I had grown up loving science fiction and fantasy, right? And as a kid, I didn't have the ability to articulate what bothered me about this genre that I adored, that didn't adore me back. It was sort of like, there's nobody in the world, and if they're in the world, there's only one of us. Like watching Star Wars, you had Lando, but it's like, I guess Black people hadn't been invented throughout all of space, just this one place, right?
So when you were growing up, there were no fantasy books with a Black girl as a kick-ass hero.
There weren't, well, I mean, there were, but I didn't learn about them until college. We weren't taught these authors in school. So I didn't know Octavia Butler was a thing until college. And I loved all this type of stuff. And now my sister started having kids. And I'm looking at their kids who are falling in love with comics and science fiction and fantasy and all this stuff. And for me, I will be damned if there's not at least one book that my babies can look at in the genre that they love to read. That's essentially what happened, is my sisters had kids and I decided to do something about their bookshelves.
Let's talk about your book and the world that you have created. How would you describe your Alice?
My Alice is essentially a whole geek. Like she's a huge nerd. It's great. I love it. And she uses both that knowledge and her experience as a Black girl in America as her superpower. That's it. And so her self-esteem, her audaciousness to think that she can be big enough to kill monsters is what lets her kill monsters.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to get a taste of your book, maybe a reading from near the beginning. Could you give us a little sense of who Alice is?
Absolutely. So let's jump in at chapter one, a few pages into the book. So we've already got a taste of Addison Hatta, who is her mentor. And at this point, he has been teaching her for a little bit, and now she's about to be armed with what can kill nightmares for the first time. Alice ran her fingers over the ivory handles of the daggers on the desk in front of her.
Cold light filled the blades, their surfaces more like silvered glass than steel. You'd think after 3 months of knowing Addison Hatta, she wouldn't be surprised whenever he pulled random weapons out. Pretty. She plucked one up and raised her eyebrows. Light. What are they? Figment blades. Addison dug around in the drawers where he sat on the other side of the desk. The old metal rattled and creaked. For real? She trailed her fingers over the flat of one of the glittering blades. The only things capable of killing nightmares. She'd never held one before, or seen one, really. They'll help focus your muchness. My much what now? Muchness. He slammed a drawer, then jumped with a curse, shaking out his hand. Your muchness, to be precise. That part of you that believes in yourself, even when the rest of you doesn't.
So the world that you've created, there's the real world that we all know, and then there is this other world. It's, you know, dropping down the rabbit hole, going into Wonderland. Can you sort of explain how these two worlds interact with each other?
Yeah. So Wonderland is connected to the world of man because it is essentially the world of dreams. From the beginning of mankind and the subconscious mind, Wonderland has been around, and it's filled with everything that is part of the human imagination, both consciously and unconsciously. And so they affect each other. Like, if something bad happens in the real world, bad stuff pops up in Wonderland, and vice versa. So Alice's job is to keep nightmares, which are physical manifestations of humanity's fears, and they pop up in Wonderland when something happens, or if, you know, enough bad feeling kind of coagulates and becomes this thing, and it tries to get to the human world because humans are the source of its power. If it can cross over, it can cause all kinds of damage, from actually physically attacking people to affecting them, and then those people will start acting out and attacking people, seemingly out of nowhere.
I have to say, this is just a great sort of taking off of sort of the whole idea of the subconscious. Dreams and nightmares, it making them real and part of our lives. You bring it to life.
Well, there's this notion that fear is a physical thing. It has a physical effect on people that we're finally, you know, starting to recognize and address. And it's sort of like stress, how now, relatively recently, there's scientific data that stress causes physical ailments within people.
Right.
Fear does the same thing. So that's kind of what I was building on, was this notion of fear being an actual danger to you, especially if it comes from places like in the book. We don't see it happen, but the characters talk about how there was a young Black girl who was around Alice's age. She was unarmed and killed by police, and Alice's community, like, the fear and the anger and the sadness generates two nightmares at once, which is a thing that Alice has never seen happen. And it's a fight that nearly costs her her life.
Yeah. And we should mention that. I mean, so this Black girl who was killed, we never actually see it happen, but there are constant references to it. How does she figure in your story?
Well, Brianne is from Alice's neighborhood, right? So this happens, and Alice's mother reacts by being scared for her own child. And so Alice is trying to, you know, be out here and do her superhero thing. But her mom is like, where are you going? Why aren't you coming home right after school? Why aren't you answering me? And Alice could be like, well, I can't answer you because my cell phone doesn't work in Wonderland. But then you have to explain what Wonderland is. And of course, Alice's mom is going to be like, you doing what now? And if her mom believes her, then she puts the kibosh on the whole thing. You're done. Like, what do you think this is? And Alice doesn't want to give that up because this is her way of coping with her own grief from the passing of her father, which happens page one of the book. And Alice thinks about it a lot as well. where she's like, I'm doing this. I am a superhero. But at the same time, I go home. Nothing is different for me. I could wind up dead in a ditch somewhere.
Right. She in Wonderland, she can get out her daggers and kill the beast. But
right.
That's different than living in Atlanta and what happens to people who actually live there.
Right. I love talking about it because there's this thing where Alice is allowed to defend herself in a reality that's not ours. It's a dream, essentially, for her to be able to defend herself. There's this whole thing where self-defense only exists if you don't have dark skin, right? If you're not black, you can defend yourself. But other than that, you're the aggressor in that case. So it has an entire effect on the book. It doesn't necessarily overshadow the book, but it's there. This is a book that it's not about race and racism, but it's not completely divested of it because that's life. So.
Yeah. So we should talk a little bit more about these nightmares that you've referred to. I mean, in your book, they become monsters. And Alice, her job in Wonderland, she is tasked with killing the nightmares, killing the monsters.
The setup is Addison is like, it's time. You've caught on really quickly. I'm kind of surprised, but impressed. Let's go kill this little nightmare. We'll kill this baby nightmare. It's fine. And they go in and this little nightmare is not so little. So Alice, even though being a superhero, she's kind of panicked. And that's where we pick up. Dad's voice filled her head. It did that a lot lately. Memories of him laughing with her, talking to her, chastising her. The tears spilled free and she shook her head. I can't, she whispered.
Breathe.
I can't.
Breathe.
I'll try.
No try. You know that. What you gonna do?
Her fingers tightened their hold on the daggers. Something swept through her, pushing outward from the center of her chest to the top of her head and the soles of her feet. This. I'ma do this. The nightmare whipped around to face her. It loosed a roar and pounded the ground with its feet. Alice adjusted her weight, then pushed off into a run. The smell of grass and dirt snapped crisp against her senses. Her steps thudded against the ground, mirroring the pounding of her heart, a storm in her chest. She darted across the meadow, coming around the monster's flank. It stood out against the black, her vision sharpening. Aim for the core. Addison's voice reached her above the scream of wind in her ears. The figment blades burned against the night. Their fire stampeded up her arms, filling her, fueling her, igniting something inside her that would never dim again. As she came down on the beast, she tightened her grip and threw her weight into the thrust. The monster roared. So did she. They collided. The book, it's sort of like how I like to reference Lemonade by Beyoncé, because that's something that a lot of people are quite aware of, is yes, the book is for black kids and black girls in general, but that doesn't mean other people can't appreciate it. So
yeah,
I never want to write anything that completely shuts anybody out, but it's always going to be geared towards the people that I write for, one way or the other.
L.L. McKinney talking with Steve Paulson. Look for her Nightmareverse YA novels, beginning with A Blade So Black. I said at the beginning of the hour that we'd be making the case for children's and YA books as a form of fiction that's uniquely qualified to empower and enchant, to restore your sense of wonder. So we'll end this hour with one last book recommended by a public radio colleague whose voice you may know.
I'm Lulu Miller, the author of Why Fish Don't Exist, and my bookmark is The Search for Delicious by Natalie Babbitt. It's a young adult novel. It's got some pictures. It's a really fun premise. There's basically this little boy named Galen, and he is helping the prime minister of this kingdom write a dictionary. And they are doing all these words, and then they get to the letter D. They get to the word delicious. And the prime minister has his idea of what delicious is. Galen has his idea. The king and the queen weigh in. They read it. I believe the king thinks delicious is an apple, and the queen thinks that's absurd, and she believes it's a certain kind of pie. I may be getting these wrong, and I apologize for not checking in advance, but everyone has their different idea of what delicious is. And so it starts this kind of squabble in the monarchy. And so Galen is sent out to survey the kingdom to find delicious. And so he has to go on this journey through all these little towns and through the forest and ask everyone he meets what they think delicious is, their definition of delicious. And so it's a really fun plot, and you get to meet all these different characters. You meet bakers and who do love bread and bakers who don't love bread, and you meet a mermaid, and you know, there's all this kind of wonderful fairy tale stuff that goes on. But along the way, she's just introducing these little philosophical questions and puzzles, like, is there an absolute delicious? Well, no, probably not. And so if there's not, is there value in subjective truth? And, you know, these aren't things she spells out like that, but it starts to, I guess it sort of like starts to let you use your 12-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, however old you are, nascent philosophical brain. And then there's all this interesting linguistic puzzle solving. So there are things like the bad guy in the story is called hemlock. And you learn that hemlock, it's a tree, but it's a poisonous tree. And the horse that Galen rides is named Marrow. And you learn, oh, marrow means like the part of, you know, the inside of a bone that really gives strength and life. There's all these subtle wordplay and word nerdness that I think for me, I remember reading this book and it was just like, it made me realize there can be an enchanting experience even with the stuff we have around us. So even just with thinking about what a word means or thinking about the definition of a word and whether there is an absolute delicious or not. I think that was this first book that let me feel the enchanting feelings even when we were obeying the laws of physics and made me realize, gosh, actually you can sometimes find magic purely through looking very closely at the world or through looking very closely at the linguistic definition of something. I think it was the first book that showed me, even if you peel back the cold, dead layer of our bleak earth, there is magic there.
Lulu Miller, co-founder of Invisibilia, co-host of Radiolab, and author of Why Fish Don't Exist. You can hear more writers on books they love on our separate micro-podcast. It's called Bookmarks. Look for it wherever you get your podcast fix. And special thanks to sound designer Sarah Hopeful for the new season. Today's show was produced by the book lovers at To the Best of Our Knowledge, Charles Monroe Kane, Shannon Henry Kleiber, Mark Rickers, Angelo Bautista, Joe Hartke, Steve Paulson, and me, Anne Strange Champs. Thanks for listening, and now get reading. From the University of Kansas, we are Kansas Public Radio, KANU and KANU HD1 Lawrence 91.5, KANH and KANH HD1 Emporia 89.7, KANV and KANV HD1 Olsburg Junction City 91.3, KANQ Chanute 90.3. Tell your smart speakers to play Kansas Public Radio. Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge on KPR comes from Delta Dental of Kansas, asking listeners when they last visited a dentist. For a preventive checkup, dentists can be found at deltadentalks.com/find. Coming up next here on Kansas Public Radio, it's NPR's news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We'll have the latest news from NPR in just 1 minute. The time is 12 o'clock. This is Kansas Public Radio.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Bill Curtis.
And I'm Peter Sagal. After what seems like years of twists and turns and ups and downs and shocks and surprises, it's finally over on Tuesday. We'll ask about the world's most maddening coin flip. Plus, actor, writer, and viral video star Brian Jordan Alvarez tells us what it's like to go legit and star in his own sitcom, English Teacher. All that plus Bill Curtis tells us his favorite costumes from Halloween this year.
Lions and tigers and beers.
We'll ask who's really having a happy hour in just a few minutes on our quiz right after this hour's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. With just 2 days until Election Day, Republican Donald Trump is campaigning in the swing states of Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia today. In Pennsylvania, at a rally in Lititz in the central part of the state, Trump repeatedly criticized the election process in the U.S.
You ought to damn well go to paper ballots. You ought to go to voter ID. And you ought to have the election over by 9 o'clock. I'm hearing now they're going to take weeks. Can you imagine? They spend all this money on machines, and they're going to say, we may take an extra 12 days to determine. And what do you think happens during that 12 days? What do you think happens?
Many states use paper ballots and require identification when voting. On the Democratic side, after her cameo appearance on Saturday Night Live, Vice President Kamala Harris heads to Michigan to campaign there most of today. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, this is the final sprint until Election Day.
For the fourth Sunday in a row, Harris is delivering remarks at a black church, this time in Detroit. Her campaign schedule also includes stops at a local restaurant in Detroit and a barbershop in Pontiac. Another long day on the campaign trail is set to end with a rally in East Lansing, home of Michigan State University. College students and black voters are key to the coalition Harris is trying to build. While the vice president is spending the whole day in Michigan, former President Trump is holding rallies in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia, which are must-win states for Trump. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Moldova is holding a runoff presidential election today. The pro-Western incumbent Maia Sandu is being challenged by a former prosecutor general who favors closer ties with Russia. Her national security adviser today claimed that authorities are seeing massive interference by Russia in the election. In Gaza City, several Palestinians, including children, have reportedly been wounded near a clinic that was giving polio vaccinations. NPR's Scott Newman reports from Tel Aviv.
The World Health Organization says the attack took place near the Sheikh Radwan Primary Health Center in northern Gaza, in an area where Israel and Hamas had earlier agreed to a humanitarian pause in the fighting. The UN organization says the strike happened as parents were bringing their children for polio vaccinations. The organization expressed concern that such attacks could deter future vaccination campaigns. The Israeli military says an initial review indicates it was not conducting operations in the area at the time. The attack comes in a weekend that UNICEF says was an especially deadly one for northern Gaza, with more than 50 children killed there. Scott Newman, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News in Washington. In Serbia, activists gathered in the capital Belgrade today to protest a deadly accident at a train station in the northern part of the country last week. A roof at the station's entrance suddenly gave way. 14 people were killed, including a 6-year-old girl. The protesters blame negligence and corruption by the Serbian government for the accident. The fastest runners have finished what's billed as the world's biggest marathon. NPR's Amy Held reports the male and female winners each pulled away in the final steps for a close finish in New York City.
Somali Dutch runner Abde Nagai won with a time of 2 hours 7 minutes 39 seconds, arms raised as he broke the tape in Central Park. And on the women's side, Sheila Chepkarui of Kenya came first at 2 hours 24 minutes 35 seconds,
she does come through,
powering past defending champion Helen Obiri. But for those who are not elite competitors and who finish several hours later, simply making it there can feel like a win. Just 4% of the 165,000 hopefuls who applied to a general lottery in March were chosen. The race began in 1970 with just a few dozen runners. Today, it surged past 50,000, drawing hundreds of thousands of spectators citywide and millions more watching around the world. Amy Held, NPR News.
Severe storms, including tornadoes, swept across Oklahoma early this morning. The Oklahoma City Police say at least 6 people were taken to hospitals. Authorities say tens of thousands of homes and businesses lost power. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include ECMC Foundation, whose North Star is to eliminate equity gaps in post-secondary completion by 2040 so that underserved learners have greater opportunity for social and economic mobility.
We're live. We're local. We are Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 91.3 Olsburg Junction City. Online at kansaspublicradio.org. Cloudy skies this afternoon. We have a chance of rain returning this evening. Then a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms overnight tonight. A nearly 100% chance of rain in the forecast for tomorrow. It's 67 degrees in Lawrence, 68 in Topeka.
The following program was taped in front of an audience of real live people.
From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm not just eye candy. I'm also ear candy. I'm Bill Curtis, and here is your host at the Studebaker Theater in the Fine Arts Building in Chicago, Illinois, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, everybody. It's great to be back with you. We were all excited to do a special Halloween show for everybody, but we realized we were just going to miss it by a couple of days. So taking inspiration from the local Walgreens, this is now a Christmas show. So later on, we're going to be talking to the amazing Brian Jordan Alvarez. He's the star of English Teacher on Hulu. But first, get on our nice list. Call in. Play our games. Give us a call at 1-888-WAIT-WAIT. That's 1-888-924-8924. Let's welcome our first listener contestant. Hi, you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm well. Who's this?
This is Megan Kane from Westfield, Massachusetts.
I know Westfield. What do you do there?
Well, I was a stay-at-home mom for a while. Now I work part-time. I'm a mentor for 5th and 6th graders at one of our public elementary schools. And coming up soon, I'll be working at the polls for Election Day on Tuesday.
Well, good for you. That is important and patriotic work, and I appreciate it. I'm also interested in the fact that you were stuck at home with your own children and you couldn't take it anymore, so you decided to go get stuck with other people's children.
A glutton for punishment, I guess.
Exactly. Well, Megan, let me introduce you to our panel this week. First up, it's the comedian and fashion designer, really, whose latest project you can see at bbspoke.shop. It's Brian Babylon. Next, it's the comedian you can see at Union Hall in Brooklyn, New York on November 23rd. It's Emmy Blotnick.
Hello. Hi, Emmy.
And he's the host of the daily podcast TBTL and the public radio variety show Live Wire, live this weekend at the Alberta Rose Theater as part of the Portland Book Festival. It's Luke Burbank.
Hey, Megan.
Megan, welcome to the show. You're, of course, going to play Who's Bill This Time. Bill Curtis is going to read you three quotations from this week's news. If you can correctly identify or explain just two of them, you will win our prize. Any voice from our show you might choose for your voicemail. Are you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Now, your first quote is the one word that everybody seems to be using to summarize something that's been going on but will finally end on Tuesday. Here is that word.
Garbage.
That was used by both candidates and many other people in the final days of what?
The election cycle.
The election, yes. We're only a few days away in the remaining hours, really, before Election Day. Both candidates are making their final push to voters. Harris's closing argument was that Trump represents a fundamental threat to democracy, while Trump's closing argument was Puerto Rico, am I right? Of course, we have to be aware of this. Tuesday will not be the end. We might not know the result of the election for weeks. Arizona campaign officials say it could take until Donald Trump is president to count all the ballots.
On the plus side, I have made text friends with some very important people.
Really?
If you saw the people that have been texting me, Luke Burbank, wild.
Are they counting on you, Luke?
I mean, I assumed I played a fairly significant role in this election, but I had no idea.
Yeah. Now, of course, I mean, it seems like this always happens. Kamala Harris had this amazing rally on the Ellipse, and Joe Biden kind of stepped on it by when he seemed to call Trump supporters garbage. His aides say that's ridiculous. He would never say that in public. And the Trump campaign, because they love this, they immediately embraced Biden's gaffe about garbage. In Wisconsin, the very next day, Donald Trump dressed as a garbage man and drove around in a garbage truck. And get this, he picked J.D. Vance as his running mate. Yeah.
But you know, the funny thing I saw when he put on that orange garbage thing, he looked like a candy corn. Did you see that? I think someone posted from the orange vest to his face to that hair. Oh. It was straight candy corn land. It was.
I see that.
No one told him, hey, man, don't. Nah, go ahead.
The tension between, like, Trump's political instincts and his team and his handlers and their sort of political instincts was in its most stark when he got into that garbage truck. Because you could tell that four people tried to say, sir,
do not get in that garbage
this
truck.
This is not a good look for you.
Yeah.
It was touch and go. He was like trying to kind of, first he couldn't get the door open, then he was trying to reach up onto these handles. There's like four Secret Service dudes that are like, do we help him?
Yeah.
Are presidents compostable?
Yeah. You're just standing there, which bin do I throw him in?
Is he litter or?
All right, Megan, here is your next quote.
Lions and tigers and beers.
That was a scientific journal summing up a new finding that what is much more common in the animal kingdom than we thought?
Drinking?
Yes, drinking alcohol. Yeah. A new study finds that deliberate alcohol use among animals of all kinds is far more widespread than we thought. From chimpanzees to fruit flies, apparently they are also watching this election. I mean, we've known that they do this, but this new study says that they do it much more than we thought, and even more than that, they do it apparently for the same reasons we do. For example, this is true. They found male fruit flies turn to alcohol after they were rejected by a potential mate. That's true. And the bartender,
oh my God.
And the bartender's like, don't worry, pal. You only live a week.
Yeah.
You should see them when there's a round of layoffs, like fruit flies that have just been fired really go after it.
Oh, yeah. You should see them drop.
Well, and also, this is true. I want to share this with you. The more alcohol they consume, the less discerning female fruit flies become about potential mates.
What kind of, first of all, high-powered microscope was this scientist using, and what drugs was he on to be like, yeah, you know what? His feelings are hurt right now.
I like the idea of the scientist looking at what seems to be a regular Petri dish, and it's just, you know, organisms, and just keeps enhancing, And then it's just like a bar.
That's what I'm saying.
Like inside the bar, and then just like one fruit fly that can't get laid. And just like, just keep in this little world of these animals.
Do you know who can hold their liquor? Hornets. Hornets, apparently, can ingest an 80% ethanol solution with no effect on their behavior, unless, of course, you count their yelling, "No, I'm okay to drive." Now, of course, I should say these animals, insects, they're not like downing shots of vodka. It's rather they're getting drunk on fermented fruits and fruit juice, right? It's more of a brunch thing.
Bottomless plums.
So this is really just buds, not people's household pets are sneaking. "Hey, man, I thought I had some Pinot in this fridge." And that's let bugs be bugs, bro.
All right. Megan, here is your last quote.
"If you do see anybody selling some cheap cheddar, can you let us know?"
That was a cheesemaker in the UK pleading for help after what happened to his cheese.
I might need a hint. Was it stolen?
It was stolen. You didn't need a hint.
Yeah.
That's right.
Amazing.
It's being called the, quote, "great cheese heist of 2024. $400,000 worth of cheddar cheese was stolen. That's 22 tons. They are going to have to steal so much lactate.
Yeah. Sounds like some savoir-faire.
A group of old-fashioned cheesemakers, the guys who do the stuff by hand, make the good stuff, say they were contacted by a man who said he represented this big French grocery chain and he wanted to place a huge order. And they were so convinced he was real. He said, so anyways, I'm looking for some fromage. And they shipped off the cheese, and when they didn't get paid, they realized they'd been ripped off. And they were heartbroken. One cheesemaker said of his stolen cheeses, quote, and this is real, "I feel like I knew each one individually."
So you know what? And if I was a detective for this,
yeah, uh-huh.
You start at their charcuterie boards and go back. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying? Wherever there's an explosion in charcuterie boards, usually
that's smart.
Hot cheese right after that.
Right. But I would say, to Brian's point, look for the criminal gang that hasn't taken a number two in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how they found him.
There's your guys.
Actually, they did catch a guy. Somebody is in custody as of showtime, and all they needed to do was wait for someone to buy 4,000 cases of Triscuits. Bill, how did Megan do in our quiz?
Fantastic. She was really hot and gets us off to a good start.
Well done, Megan. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Oh, please, somebody ring the cheese alarm.
Okay, panel, it is time for a brand new game that we are calling
What's Dame Helen Mirren Up To This Week?
So, Luke, you're our player for this inaugural edition.
Okay.
What is Dame Helen Mirren, the legendary British actress, up to this week? Is it A, talking with great emotion about aging, her career, and how, quote, "if you love what you do, it never feels like working, it's playing," or B, she was talking about aging and how, quote, "it's so sad that Kurt Cobain died when he did because he never saw GPS.
I pray to God it's number two.
It is, in fact, B, yes. Congratulations. During an interview with the Evening Standard newspaper, the celebrated actress, completely unprompted, started talking about Kurt Cobain and GPS, something she loves, and she says she regrets that Cobain never got to experience it. Shockingly, this is not the first time that Dame Helen Mirren has talked about Kurt Cobain and technology. In the past, she mentioned how sad she was that he had never seen a laptop or been on the internet.
Somebody needs to check Dame Helen Mirren's, like, trapper keeper, because I feel like she has written on there, Mrs. Helen Cobain, but over and over again. This is an old school crush.
Yeah.
This guy's taking up a lot of real estate in her brain.
No, she's imagining the Insta handle, like, at Kurt and Helen, you know. She's
right.
Like,
eat some Dippin' Dots, you think about Kurt.
And that he never had them.
Yeah.
Coming up, business or pleasure in our Bluff the Listener game. Call 1-888-WAIT-WAIT-TO-PLAY. We'll be back in a minute with more of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Pennsylvania's most recent Republican governor, Tom Corbett, wants people to trust the election process. He says former President Donald Trump's false claims about election fraud have undermined people's faith in elections.
4 years into this, there hasn't been any evidence that anything was rigged.
We talked to him about reestablishing trust in the most important state on the map, on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 5 o'clock this afternoon on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, we're 91.5 Lawrence and 89.9 Atchison. You can find us online at kansaspublicradio.org.
Support for KPR comes from Inequatoria, Andrew Sherwood, Ph.D., Jungian analyst. C.G. Jung suggested that dreams are intentional messages from the unconscious that, when interpreted correctly, provide balance and guidance in life. More at workingwithdreams.com.
When you think of a dangerous abolitionist in Kansas history, you probably think of John Brown. Next time on KPR Presents, the most dangerous abolitionist you probably haven't heard of before. I'm Kay McIntyre. Join me for a conversation with Todd Melfeld and David Schaefer about James Montgomery and his war on slavery. That's on KPR Presents, 6 o'clock this evening on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for NPR.